You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
0.1 KFCF from Fresno and online at kpfa.org. It's 5 p.m. Up next, Flashpoints.
Tucson, Arizona, on the front lines of the battle for immigrants' rights, it's Flashpoints. Today on the show, an in-depth discussion with ethnic studies professor and human rights activist Nolan Cabrera. I'm Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Gavila Molina. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is Dennis Bernstein here in Tucson, Arizona, with Miguel Gavila Molina. And, well, we have a week of incredible programming planned for you. Today we have coming up, as I said on the show, a very powerful in-depth interview with a college professor who is also on the front lines of defending ethnic studies in the city and the book ban. So this is an amazing way to start the week, isn't it, Miguel?
No, absolutely. The cultural wars here in Arizona have always been ground zero. And as we see right now, as we speak, this incredible historical crisis of the shutdown of the government in Washington, D.C. Over a border wall, what we call El Muro. And here we are, Arizona, ground zero, and we're about to, in the next day or so, also be dealing with the Native American Congress gathering here with the Yaqui Tohono nations, the Indian nations that are on the border, on both sides of the border, to address this. It's almost like a face-off with federal government Washington, D.C. officials meeting face-to-face with the Indians. It's like, as our very dear friend, Mr. Bill Means, one of the founders of the American Indian Movement, has put it, the Indian wars have continued. They haven't stopped. And here we are dealing with that face-off.
And we're going to be talking tomorrow in terms of the brutal battle at the border. We'll be speaking with Isabel Garcia, who has been an attorney and a frontline fighter. She's the one that helps to make the crosses that they put up every year in terms of the hundreds of folks who are dying in the desert, a desperate death because of this kind of policy. So we'll be speaking with her tomorrow, and we'll be out in the field speaking with the journalist who's been covering this story for 25 years. We're looking forward to that and much, much more.
Absolutely. And tomorrow's going to be interesting because tomorrow, the border summit with the Indian nations, the Yaqui Tohono, and the federal officials will be held at the Casa del Sol, the casino there of the Tohono Nation. And it's going to be interesting to see where it all ends, because the government is threatening to come through their sacred sovereign land to build this wall. And what we've gathered from the locals, from our contacts, people that have contributed to the show here, is that no way that's going to happen. And people, the native folks here in the area, are getting ready for a standoff, like we saw a little over a year ago at North Dakota Standing Rock. This is about to become the next Standing Rock.
All right. Well, Dennis Bernstein here with Miguel Gavila Molina. We've got our good friend Free Will and Frank Sterling doing the technical work and doing some of his own reporting. We're delighted to be here. So coming up right now, please stay tuned for a very interesting in-depth interview with somebody who knows a great deal about what's going on the ground here in Tucson, Arizona. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
Tucson, Arizona. I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And we're down here in Tucson to sort of document the situation, what's happening here in this land that used to be Mexico, what's happening at the border. We have plenty to bring you, and we're going to start with a deep overview, and we're delighted to welcome as our first guest down here in Tucson, Nolan Cabrera. He's an associate professor. He works at the Center for the Study of Higher Education, College of Education, University of Arizona. He played a key role in informing the court in terms of the possibilities and the powers of ethnic studies. You might remember ethnic studies where there was a cleansing in this town and there was a battle. It went to the courts. I think you won, but I think it's on appeal. There's a lot to talk about. Welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Why don't you begin with the country is shut down because the president of the United States wants a wall. Tucson and parts south, Nogales, this is the front line of that battle. Why don't you give us a sense of how this policy has impacted on the region and some of the kinds of suffering that it has caused?
I think one of the biggest things that's happened, it's not necessarily a policy issue, but it's more that when you have someone in the power, in the position of the president of the United States, saying such overtly racist things, it emboldens the racists on a local level to act even more forcefully. And it enables people in a local level to be even more brutal to brown people. And it heightens even more xenophobia. So we saw this on a micro level here in Arizona when there was HB 2281, which is the anti-Mexican-American studies bill, and SB 1070, the anti-immigrant bill that all came down in the summer of 2010. So when you had the governor saying these ridiculously racist things about brown people in Arizona, you know, that you have to be careful in the desert because the drug lords are out there and they're cutting people's heads off and just things that have no bearing at all. You see almost identical rhetoric happening right now. But Trump will say things like, well, there's prayer rugs out there, so obviously there's Muslims crossing the border. The next 9/11 is going to happen on the border. And so what ends up happening is that because people are so emboldened to act racistly, that they end up taking it out on folk. And that can be on a local level, just people threatening. It can be, I mean, we've seen a peak in mass shootings, especially amongst disaffected white men. And then also you've seen Border Patrol just get out of control. Like the handcuffs were off and they weren't really on that tightly to begin with. And so the brutality that people are experiencing on the border is absolutely ridiculous. And then recently here in Tucson, we had a horrible, horrible case where you had humanitarian aid workers leaving water out in the desert for migrants. And Border Patrol has consistently said, you know, they're only enabling migrants to come across. They're only enabling migrants to come across. And no, they're just preventing people from dying. And they recently were found guilty of basically littering. As ridiculous as that sounds, leaving water in the desert is, and so they were cited for that, for doing that in a national forest. And this is like such a minor thing, but it's so important for the people who are crossing.
And to follow up on that, so to be clear here, the Border Patrol is interceding in a way that could cause the loss of life.
Very simply put, yes. They've
and they're arrested.
There's actually images that people have gotten and video of Border Patrol agents taking that water and dumping it out. Before, you know, 10 years ago or so, the primary people who dump it out were Minutemen who'd use these areas as target practice. And now, with being more emboldened under a Trump administration, Border Patrol agents are like, no, we need to take away every single thing that would enable these folks from coming through. And what they forget is that these folks are in such dire circumstances, it doesn't turn them back. They don't turn back. All that it does, it makes their journey more difficult and it means more people are going to die. There's a point of entry down south where there are these massive billboards and public service announcements all over the place that the Mexican government has put up saying, turn back. Turn back. Just, it's not worth your life. Don't do it. And one of my colleagues over in public health asked the question down there one time, how many people have turned back? They said zero. These people have, I mean, some dude who's come out of freaking Chiapas all the way to the north because he's so having a difficult time and this is his only refuge, not going to sit there and turn back. They don't understand the circumstances that these folks are coming through. And more importantly, they don't want to acknowledge the United States' complicity in those situations, in the destabilization of governments in Central America, and using Mexico as sort of a puppet government as well.
You're listening to Flashpoints. We're in Tucson. Miguel Gavilan Molina is here. Free Will and Frank has agreed to engineer our week here in Tucson. When I was here in 1985, I spent a lot of time between Tucson and Nogales and the border. At that time, and I've talked about this before, there could be some kind of family affair on the Mexican side of the border. You could go to church in Mexico, get married, and have the reception in Nogales, Arizona. All that has changed. And this is, then there wasn't a problem with crime. You just stepped over the fence, if there was a fence at all. Yeah. You want to talk about those kinds of, the quality of life and those kinds of changes that have occurred?
Absolutely. Well, I think that the real big tipping point was 94 with Operation Gatekeeper that came on the heels of NAFTA. I mean, NAFTA was so big that Mexico had to change its constitution in order to get into this free trade agreement. And then right at that point was when you saw the militarization of the border. And let's not forget that the people who were really leading the calls for the militarization of the border were Democrats Dianne Feinstein and Bill Clinton. And I was talking with a sociology student who was going through some internal U.S. documents a few years back, and the people who were doing the assessments, like what would actually happen as a result of putting up these walls, putting up these barriers, and militarizing the border, they knew that this isn't going to stop the flow of people coming north. People come north. People walk across a desert because they're desperate. They come from desperate, dire circumstances. The irony, of course, is that so many people are afraid of people walking across the desert, have no idea what it's like here. If they spent one day in a Tucson summer here, they would change their mind in a second because nobody walks across a desert just willy-nilly. Oh, it's great. I'm going to do this. And so the U.S. government's own estimations knew that people were going to die as a result of just getting filtered more away from the cities and into the desert areas. And that's what we're experiencing right now, is it's certainly this out of sight, out of mind. As long as it's not overcrowding at the big cities, then the big cities aren't going to overthrow the powers that be. And if they don't overthrow the powers that be, if it's put out into the deserts, if it's put onto the native reservations, if this flow of migrants go in these areas that are more desolate, more people are going to die, rural folk who the powers that be don't really care about that much. They're going to be able to sort of it's sort of plausible deniability. Just let them go in that direction. And it's only been amplified ever since then. So you had Operation Gatekeeper, NAFTA, and then when 9/11 happened, then it became even increased militarization, which is ironic because the people who blew up the World Trade Centers came over on planes and they were Saudi Arabian. But again, we don't deal with facts in these situations. We deal with these impulses. And the impulse is that brown people, especially from the southern border, are dangerous, deadly. They're, you know, really all that Trump was saying was what was right beneath the surface, that, you know, they're bringing their rapists and their drug dealers and stuff like that. Those have been mental models that people have had about Mexican migrants for years. Without the slightest hint of irony, then going over to their Whole Foods, getting their organic celery and produce and saying, oh, this is so great, forgetting that those exact people you're demonizing pick that exact fruit that you're eating.
Now, I understand the figure is over 8,000 people have died on the desert. Do we know how many people have been left to die? And that is a horrible way to die.
Absolutely. We don't actually, I mean, the problem is we don't actually know the exact numbers. We know the number of people who've gone, who have disappeared. We know the number of bodies who've been found. We've known the number of bodies who've been found by Border Patrol, the number of bodies who've been found by, you know, people who are just out in the desert, by humanitarian aid workers. And so that, you know, whenever the estimates come out, they always tend to be a lowball estimate. And you're right, that's a horrible, horrible, horrible way to die, because what people also forget is that, and you'll experience this here in Tucson now, the days are poundingly hot, but the nights, because the desert is so wide open, that the cold can get you too. And then the lack of, I mean, the lack of water out there, the lack of supplies, and you're doing a 3 or 4 day hike through the desert of Arizona. That's incredibly physically taxing. And again, these are people who it should be a testament to their will and what they are going through and what, that's exactly the type of person who we would want in here, that with that will, drive, and desire. And yet they're demonized constantly as the bane of our society. You know, and in many respects, it becomes a social distraction. That is, as long as you're pointing the finger at brown people and making them the enemy, they're not going to point the finger at Donald Trump.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Dennis Bernstein here in Tucson, and we're broadcasting from Tucson this week, and we're here for a reason. Obviously, there's a battle at the border. We're going to be dealing with a lot of different issues to do with what's going on here, but I want to ask you to talk a little bit more about the Border Patrol. Now, I remember back a couple of years, there was the murder of Ezekiel, the 16-year-old goat herder who was shot down by the U.S. military. It's only gotten worse. Talk about the multiple shootings and the way in which things have intensified at that level.
Absolutely. So, first of all, Border Patrol, if they were acting with borderline impunity earlier, now it's even heightened. So we recently had a case in Tucson a few months back that was heard where a Border Patrol agent, he said, same thing, you know, I'm getting rocks thrown at me across the border. So he shot into Mexico and shot a young man and killed him, and he was acquitted. And part of the evidence that people were arguing was that, well, that first shot was really in self-defense. That first shot was the one that killed him. So the six other ones that he threw, that he discharged, mm-hmm. they don't matter. And I was like, wait a minute. That just doesn't. You've got to be kidding me. But this is not something, at least in Tucson, that is new. Right when I came here in early 2010, 2011, there was a Border Patrol agent. A very similar situation, but this one was more face-to-face. And so he was about a 6'3", 6'4", 280-pound Border Patrol agent. And there was about a 5'4", 150-pound migrant. And they were saying that, you know, this guy was threatening this Border Patrol agent with a rock, trying to crush his skull in. I mean, I was there listening to the defense, and they were just, you know, this guy who's met, you saw... I mean, even the optics that were going on in the courtroom, they had the Border Patrol agent lose a lot of weight so he looked less physically intimidating when it came to trial. I mean, it was all sorts of things like that. And so it was just this massive size discrepancy. And from when the forensic report came back, the Border Patrol agent had shot the migrant from about 18 inches away.
18 inches.
I mean, just like right there. I mean, that's more of an assassination than they're saying, oh, self-defense, self-defense. And I'm so tired of self-defense because I'll give sort of a very simplistic metaphor, but like when I was doing youth development work, we had to make like a no-fighting policy because some kids would say, well, you know, if someone punches me, I'm going to punch them back. But what would they do? They would poke and poke and poke until someone assaults them, and then it gave, you know, allowed them to do it. We're not looking at the offensive procedures that Border Patrol has been going through. We aren't looking at that. It's always that, you know, these poor defenseless Border Patrol agents in their military equipment, fully armed with the sanctioning of the federal government and the local governments and everything like that, that they're under attack some way. No, they're not. If we're honest about it, they're on the offense. And there's a reason why the Border Patrol Union is standing with the shutdown right now, because they know which side of the bread their bread is buttered on, because Trump has said, you know, do whatever you have to do. And again, I mean, it can only get worse from here. They need they need to go through more processes and slow down on that, because this is not – you have people – I mean, it's creating a culture of fear and intimidation. And then the irony, of course, is that then they paint themselves as the ones who are – or the Border Patrol paints themselves as the ones who are really under attack, when, again, they're the ones who are on offense.
Again, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, Professor, I'd like you to – let's put on your professor's cap here and talk a little bit about racism in the context of the educational system. You've been on the cutting edge and in defense of ethnic studies, which you have demonstrated has been an incredibly positive and effective program. Do you want to talk about your battle to protect ethnic studies and what is driving the forces against it? It does seem like the last gasp of the white minority state.
So there's a favorite quote of mine. I know it's a complete cliche, but the idea is that people attribute it to Einstein, some say someone else, but it was that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Taken to academics, you say, okay, you have these massive inequalities along racial lines. What are we going to do about it? And inevitably people say, well, you know, we'll add tutoring programs. We'll do this. We'll do that. It doesn't really radically change things. Why people feel threatened about ethnic studies, first of all, is that it's dramatically different. It's totally different in the way that it conceptualizes of school. I mean, it freaked people out here locally. Where you had 16, 17-year-old kids advocating for their own educational opportunities and the educational opportunities in their communities on a district level, state level, doing sit-ins, doing write-ins, testifying before Senate judiciary Senate committees. That people are afraid of youth. We need to remember that like an empowered youth populace makes people very afraid. The other problem is that ethnic studies, when done well, because there's a lot of different ways that ethnic studies can be done, and not all are equally effective. You can't take out Shakespeare, put in Maya Angelou, and say, hey, ethnic studies. It doesn't work like that. You have to take a critical analysis to the cause and consequences and potential solutions to inequality, specifically along racial lines. And to do that, you have to start getting an analysis of the structure of racial inequality. So all too often, it makes good liberal white people feel really good about racism, like, I'm the good white person. Those white guys in Charlottesville are the bad white person. And instead, we take an alternative approach that says, no, it's akin to capitalism. We're all participating in the system that represents and reproduces inequality. And so then the question is, what do your localized actions and initiatives do in relation to that larger systemic reality? And so this whole thing about I'm a good person because I'm not racist doesn't mean anything. It's about we live in a racist society. It's a structural reality, and we have to undo that. And then that doesn't make people feel good because then, especially white people, because it makes them feel, especially even the term white privilege, because it makes them feel as if they didn't completely earn what it is that they've received. Now, that's an honest and accurate assessment historically and contemporarily in terms of if we're doing an analysis of educational opportunity, very, very accurate. But it doesn't make them feel good. And that's very troubling because that also means that a lot of the backlash we're receiving regarding ethnic studies is because it hurts white people's feelings. And that's really troubling. Like a primary barrier to educational equity, this massive pathway, because we didn't just do our analysis in Tucson. There was another one replicated up in San Francisco Unified that found very, very similar results. And a lot of the big barriers that we're getting because of that or because it hurts people's feelings, that's ridiculous. You know, I'll take tangible material, educational inequality. That should trump people's feelings at any point in time.
Again, you're listening to Flashpoints. And, Professor, let's talk a little bit more about the power of ethnic studies. I think what is so troubling is that how you and others have demonstrated how effective it has been. Now, we were here, I believe it was 2010, when the battle was in full force, when they were literally coming in and sort of undermining, literally attacking the teachers and pulling the rug right out in front of the students. This was brutal. And we interviewed some of the students who said, among other things, we heard from students that it was ethnic studies that literally gave them a reason to live. And we also heard from students that losing this could devastate their lives. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So if we go back to the foundations of ethnic studies, the brilliant historian Ronald Takaki out of UC Berkeley had a very statement where he said, what happens when somebody with the power of a teacher puts forth a history and you aren't in it? It's like looking in, it creates a moment of psychic disequilibrium, like you looked into a mirror and saw nothing. And so then what ethnic studies does in part is it provides that different mirror where you can actually see yourself. And you can, and it's so, it is such a powerful tool because you start building a sense of self and self-worth that, to be blunt, a lot of white people take for granted. When you look at the founding fathers, you can see yourself represented in that, whereas a lot of people of color can't. And so when you're told that all of the greatness of our society stems specifically from largely white, male, straight people who are landowners and also slave owners, I mean, that sends a very troubling message about your and your own community's self-worth. And in addition, this it gets to a structural level because in low-income communities, success is so frequently defined as I'm leaving. Why is that? Because there's, you know, they're like, well, such poverty-ridden, quote-unquote, all these areas, you know, there's so much crime. And so then if you're growing up in that, who are the people, who are your role models that you see every day? They're the people who, quote-unquote, couldn't get out. And that sends a troubling message to you about you and your community's worth. And part of what ethnic studies does is it says, no, you are a person of worth. You are a community of worth. You are valuable. And actually, as a matter of fact, our community can't thrive unless you succeed. Like the future success of our community is predicated upon your education. Not to put too much pressure on you, kid, but this is what we need. And you see some amazing, amazing results out of it. One of the most fantastic things that's come out of it, there's a group that called Flowers and Bullets out of Tucson. And they had a very simple analysis that was so profound. And they said, where is the healthy food in South Tucson? Because Tucson is a foodie capital of the country. We, you know, you go around, we have farmers markets, organic fruits, organic foods, all this stuff. And they said, where is that on the south side, in the brown side of town? I mean, it's dramatic. You go south of 22nd, boom, it turns, signs turn to Spanish, people are brown, people are speaking Spanish. Where's the sustainable food there? So they created this group called Flowers and Bullets that's a local community-oriented organic farming where they produce their own things. They produce their own meat. They produce their own vegetables. They produce their they just planted a bunch of cacti. I mean, it's amazing the energy that they have, but it became this critique of inequality, racist inequality in their community, and then they did something about it. Because they had that sense of self, like, I am of worth, our community is of worth, and we're not getting served. What are we going to do with it? That's the power of ethnic studies, is that it gives those students who've been told for so many years that they are worthless and gives them a sense of purpose in a very real and material way. And it has extraordinary and transformative potential, as we've seen here and throughout many locales throughout the country.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Dennis Bernstein here in Tucson, and we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Professor Cabrera about the DACA students being thrown in the middle by Trump again, about the importance of TPS and how these kids are being used as pawns in this political game. Short break. We'll be right back.
Mr. President? Are you listening, Mr. President? Open your ears.
President.
Mr. President.
I want your weapons.
Mr. President.
My destruction.
Mr. President.
I won't swallow.
Mr. President.
Your concoctions, yeah.
Mr. President.
I can tell.
Mr. President.
From your eyes.
Mr. President.
Oh, you beat me.
Mr. President.
Your lies.
Mr. President.
Fill your pockets.
Mr. President.
With black gold.
Mr. President.
Turn your feet back.
Mr. President.
What you saw.
Mr. President.
Turn your feet back.
Mr. President.
And we're back in Tucson. This is Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints. We're spending the week down south. We're going to be going to the border, reporting to you about what's happening here as a result of the latest policies by Donald Trump regarding the border. And we are delighted to be joined by somebody who knows a great deal about this subject, Professor Nolan Cabrera. He's an associate professor and works with the Center for the Study of Higher Education, College of Education, University of Arizona. He has written extensively about all the issues that we're talking about. I want to turn your attention to Joe Arpaio, the sheriff, who was convicted and then pardoned by Donald Trump. He worked with somebody that our listeners might know something about, Chris Kobach, who created CrossCheck. This is a guy who really, based on his activities, is not only a racist, but he is a serial white supremacist who believes in structurally changing the laws so that brown people and black people, people of color, have less rights. You want to talk a little bit about Arpaio being pardoned, the impact of that, and the kind of racial policies that have come out of that?
Absolutely. So there's a lot going on there. First of all, there's a really biting irony in the situation where the GOP continually touts themselves as the law and order party, the law and order party. But when one of their own gets convicted, it's boom, pardon. And that was just – and it hit people hard because it took so much effort to get Arpaio convicted. And for years – everybody knew what was going on. It wasn't – he didn't hide it. It was out – you know, he put up these tent cities and would just demean people on a regular basis, racially profile brown folks throughout the Maricopa area. You know, and then, again, it was the same thing that I was talking about earlier where with the Border Patrol where he turns himself into the ultimate victim. You know, he'd say, well, you know, if I'm going into a store, I have to – you know, I have to park in a handicapped zone because it gives the least amount of open time between my car and the store because people are trying to kill me all over the place. It's this ridiculous racial paranoia that then gets justified to or is used to justify overtly racist policies. Because what we forget is that, you know, if we're talking about quote unquote illegals, I hate that term, but undocumented people, you know, we need to be honest about the number of undocumented Canadians who are coming across the border. Right when he left, Paul Ryan made a really big push on looking at undocumented Irish folk. And it's sort of like, Canadians, Irish, what do all these folk have in common? Well, the perception is that they're white and the brown, and so they're not dregs on society, and these are brown people, so they are. And it's a very easy shorthand to just basically associate brown with criminality, brown with the rapists, brown with the drug dealers. It's a very simple cognitive mechanism that Arpaio and Kobach have been using very, very effectively for a very long time. But they've been trying, like you said, to get to the structural level, hence things like SB 1070, where you just do an incredible amount of harm to migrants, taking away DACA protections, which was one of Trump's first executive orders. And so you're hitting all of these issues on a really hard systemic level, but using just systemic racism as a leverage point to do that. Because let's be honest, if it was if any of this was posed against white people, it wouldn't fly at all. Like if they said, well, you know, we're really concerned about illegal Canadians coming across the border. And, you know, if some of those, you know, if some people who kind of look Canadian in Washington and Oregon get picked up along the way, well, I guess that's just the way it goes. That would be absurd. But that's the reality of what happens down here. And what also people forget is that it's not just that undocumented folk live in one specific area, right? They're intermingled throughout different communities. And so as these giant sweeps are occurring, you end up with people who are actually documented, who are actually citizens, who are actually from here, who get swept up in the process. And it's absolutely ridiculous because you have U.S. citizens who are fearing for their own safety, not saying that it's okay with undocumented people, but then you also have U.S. citizens who are fearing for their own safety because they realize that in these times, in this era, if you're brown, it's the reverse of the way the law should work. You're not innocent until proven guilty. You're guilty until proven innocent. So if you happen to go play a pickup game of basketball, you forget your ID, you better get home quickly to make sure you can prove, yes, I am from here. And even sometimes that doesn't do it. It's a scary, scary thing because what you have is the power, the systemic power of the government coming down to enact racism on a local level, which makes communities afraid and ironically makes us less safe in the process.
It is interesting because at the same time, you've got sort of, shall we say, the revolutionary taco truck movement, where all the white people in Phoenix are angry because the authorities are getting in the way of them getting some of the best tacos and probably a very good buy on those tacos. So there is a cultural mingling, and there is something happening despite this racism. You want to talk about that?
Sure. I find it kind of amusing but also a little demeaning that, you know, the vanilla suburbs will only get upset about this issue to the extent that it prevents them from getting – from taking advantage of all of the wonderful things that Mexican culture and Central American – different Central American cultures have to offer. But what I will say is it also speaks to the high levels of segregation that we experience in our contemporary society, and that is that in a weird way, the farther – there's a strange phenomenon. The farther away that you get from this problem, the more afraid of it that you get. You know, I have the dangdest time. I'm originally from McMinnville, Oregon. It's almost impossible for me to convince people back home that we're not being invaded. Like, they're just so convinced. They've been so Fox Newsed that they can't believe. They're like, no. And I heard this one report about this one drug dealer and this cartel, and they dug this hole and they did this. And I was like, I live it on a daily basis. I am here. I study this. People around me study this. We're not anywhere close to being invaded. Even if you look at the government statistics on apprehensions, they're going down, 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 down. We're going, even without a wall, we're going in this direction. What are you afraid of? And that's the weird part about it, is it taps into this weird xenophobic imaginary where it's kind of like when you were a kid and you were sure that the boogeyman was under your bed. But the second that you look, you're like, oh, there's nothing to be afraid of. The problem is that so many people who are so far away from the border refuse to look. They think they know what they're talking about and they don't. And that only makes things worse because the more that people's fears are heightened, the more irrational that they become, and the more that they will forego authority and give it to the federal government and give it to Trump to say, yes, please protect us, when in fact there's nothing to be protected from. Trump came at the situation with a solution in search of a problem, and he's becoming very good at generating that there is a reality of the problem when there isn't.
Let's talk about DACA. Now, Trump has thrown them right in the middle of the current battle between the Republicans and the Democrats. And we have to be real that both the Republicans and the Democrats have abandoned this issue, turned their back on these problems and the need for real, humane immigration reform. We saw Obama set up the DACA students with that kind of structure in which they give over everything they are, all the information the authorities need. And then when Trump comes in, cancels, there are a lot of people facing a lot of problems. You want to talk about how DACA is now being used? Trump says, here's the deal. Look, Democrats, look what we're giving you. We're going to give you DACA and we're going to give you a renewal of TPS for a couple of years.
Yeah. So first of all, I think that last point that you had there was the core issue, that it's for a couple of years, and it's not DACA. It's just DACA protection. It's not like DACA pathway to citizenship. It's not like DACA, you know, actually giving you any kind of rights. It's like DACA at the very, very, very bare minimum. And let's not forget also that you know, Trump was the one who rescinded these protections in the first place. And so he's sort of like an arsonist turned fireman. Like, hey, aren't you glad that I put out the fire in your house? You caused it. No, but I saved you. And it's like, no, you can't have it both ways, right? He relies – actually, it's sort of important that he's on Twitter because – he relies so much on an ahistorical analysis of what he specifically has done. But I think your analysis is 100% correct too, that DACA has been sort of like the redheaded stepchild of the Democratic Party. Like, they haven't fully embraced this, and even when they were in charge, they kept promising. You know, when they held the chambers of Congress and the presidency, they didn't really advance this in any meaningful way, even though they had the opportunity to. And now we're feeling the end results of what I call the spineless Democrats, because so many of them are thinking, you know, if we could just get back to a return to civility, if we could just – no, we're so far beyond that. That's so 1987. Like, go talk to, you know, Reagan and Tip O'Neill if you want to go have that conversation. We're beyond that right now. It's time to roll up your sleeves and actually get down and fight. I was completely surprised that Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi have actually been holding their ground recently. But the true colors of the Democrats right now are showing through in their response to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, where she's having some very, you know, some actually very popular ideas put forth on a Green New Deal, you know, and things like that. And they're just like, no, you don't, you know, Claire McCaskill leaving the Senate, don't go after her. She's just a shiny new thing. Like, how diminutive, how insulting can you be to, you know, not just a fellow female legislator, but a woman of color, young up and comer? Let's not kid ourselves and say that the Democrats have in any way embraced DACA. But at the same time, it really is the Republicans who are holding DACA hostage and using it as this, you know, using it as this little carrot. Hey, you can get DACA. You can get DACA. Weren't you the ones who eliminated DACA? No, forget about that. This is our, you know, this is our bargaining tool. In some respects, maybe that was the whole point of eliminating DACA in the first place, was to create that bargaining chip.
I want to ask you, what are some of the issues that maybe we didn't ask you about that you feel are pressing, some stories that we might want to know more about? Give us your sense of your bigger picture.
Okay. It's interesting right now. One thing that I've been seeing recently, both on a national level as well, but it's really manifest on a local level, is the there's been such a push for teacher pay, teacher equity, you know, increase in pay and social and support services and things like that in schools. Yeah, there was a strike in LA, and so then we also had one last year, Red for Ed, here in Arizona, and that was really the only way that teachers could get a pay raise and get all these structures. And again, it was one of these weird things where, you know, the state had taken away a few billion dollars from public education during the recession, never returned it, and then thinks against the same benevolence. You know, you create this problem, but you don't actually do anything about it. And then when people agitate, you're like, you know, Governor Ducey's like, you teachers are going to get a 20% pay raise because of this great work that I'm doing. It's like, no, they had to strike in order for you to. They had to protest and demonstrate in order for you to even make any headway on that. And what I'm concerned about right now is now we're coming to a time of backlash. And so there's a just north of here in Oro Valley, there's a state rep who's introducing a number of bills that, for example, if you're a teacher who helps create a school closure because of, for say, a strike, you could be held individually liable and be fined $5,000 for that. This is a really strange thing. He introduced a bill that actually reintroduces some of the language from the anti-ethnic studies bill under a different guy. And I'm like, you realize that was already found unconstitutional, but he's re-implementing it and he's re-upping on that. He introduced a bill to try to get teachers to be less political in their classrooms. And the thing is, it's a repetitive bill. Teachers are already not allowed to advocate for political positions in their classrooms. But he's doing it because he says, well, you know, during this time, the teachers were overtly political and indoctrinated, and I've been flooded with comments from upset parents. Here was the problem. Someone looked at his records. He received one email from an upset person, and it occurred after he had already introduced this legislation. But the problem is that right now is the prime time for a backlash, in particular against public education. They say, well, the teachers have gone too far. And I'm like, no, what we have is a compromise solution. The teachers worked as hard as they could, but they're not going far enough because of the structural issues that they're dealing with. And so now is the time for the backlash. And I'm really concerned about that backlash because that's the kind of thing that can really do long-lasting harm. And under a Trump presidency, it can really facilitate some negative outcomes because people feel more emboldened that up in Washington they're talking like this. Down at my local level, it feels kind of like a collective movement.
And it was shocking to me when we were down here, they literally instituted a book ban. A ban on books, a profound – you want to talk about that? I mean, this is how far they are willing to go.
Absolutely.
So this could be coming back, this kind of policy.
Absolutely.
So back when ethnic studies was made illegal by HB 2281, the Anti-Mexican-American Studies bill, the state kept saying the district is out of compliance. The district is out of compliance. One thing that was really interesting about that too is that the very first findings of noncompliance came from Tom Horn. They came before the statute.
Remind people.
Oh, sorry. Yes. So Tom Horn was the state superintendent of public instruction who was just adamantly against ethnic studies. And so he agitated for about 3 years to create a bill that would allow him to eliminate, in particular, the highly successful Mexican-American studies program in Tucson, Arizona. Once that bill was passed, it didn't go into effect immediately. It went into effect on January 1st of the next year. Well, he was leaving office, so he issued a finding of noncompliance. Tucson Unified hadn't been in class yet. They were, so there was nothing to find out of compliance. They were already guilty. As a result of that, there was a localized judicial struggle. I'm not going to go into all the nuances of that, but for the next year, there was an administrative law hearing where Tucson was found out of compliance. And then they just threw in the towel. And they just said, "Okay, we're going to eliminate the Mexican American Studies program." And so directly after that, administrators from TUSD, Tucson Unified School District, went into the classrooms and boxed up the books that were being taught. So 500 Years of Chicano History, Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed, The Tempest, like all these different things. And they kept saying, well, it's not a book banning, but unfortunately there was a picture circulating where one of the boxes was actually marked banned books, and it was put in a depository for where they weren't available to anybody. And so they'd say, well, you know, the district would hide behind, well, you know, there's a couple copies at this specific branch of the library. Well, you had 50,000 students and two copies of a book. It became a de facto book banning. But here was the interesting thing that I found about that is, you know, maybe the students are reading Henry David Thoreau's Civil Disobedience, right? That book is not banned throughout the state. It was only in this locale where it was low-income brown kids who would actually do something in the spirit of civil disobedience, that it became threatening enough to ban it. And so from a technical perspective, it wasn't like a book banning across the board. It was like a targeted banning that said, these kids are threatening, so we're going to take away knowledge from them. And so in some ways it was even more insidious than just a general book banning. It wasn't just saying this idea is threatening. It's saying this idea with these social agents is threatening to the tranquility of the state. And it's one of those things that it's just, you know, and I go around and around with folks. They keep saying, insisting, this wasn't a book banning. It wasn't a book banning. Look, you told the teachers they couldn't teach them. You took them out of the classroom. You put them in a depository where no one could get to them. You're, you know, being complicit with what was later found in federal court to be a racist state. I mean, that was what the federal government or the federal judge said, that the state acted in racial animus in eliminating Mexican-American studies. By going along with it, you were complicit in that, and you were complicit in a book banning. That's it. And it's scary because that should be – that's supposed to be, you know, that's supposed to be Nazi Germany time, not, you know, 2019 – or was it 2012 Tucson?
And finally, how – as a teacher, how has your work changed? Are you dealing with more and more students who are frightened, whose families are frightened? That must impact on the whole educational process right at grassroots where you work.
Absolutely. So the most noticeable thing that I've seen since Trump came into power is that my students are really – they have – their fuse is really, really short right now. And I'm not. Please keep in mind, I'm not saying that to say there's something wrong with them. I really understand it, but they're under so much stress right now on multiple levels. Can I pay for school? Can I pay for groceries? Is my mom going to get deported? It's just this constant barrage that they're dealing with, and it makes education seem like we go through educational theory. It makes it seem kind of trivial. Like, why in the heck are we even doing this right now? If my mom gets deported, I don't care what John Dewey said. Like, you know, that's and at the same time, you can feel the stress in the classroom, and it doesn't have anything to do with the dynamics of the class. It's just people are stressed, and so. What used to be something that you know, what used to be things in the classroom that we would, you know, oh, someone misspoke, we'll kind of, you know, we'll work through it, we'll figure this out. Those things have just blown up, and they blow up really, really quickly into dramatic issues. And it's a structural thing that, you know, the more stress that somebody is under, the less that they can, you know, that you can brush it off your shoulder, the less that you're able to really deal with this. And so just, you know, emotions are heightened, anger is heightened, frustration is heightened. And unfortunately, a lot of us are taking it. And it's not just in the classroom. It happens all over the community. People are taking it out on each other as well. You know, you see people in their interpersonal relationships that those are getting more tense. Friends aren't speaking to each other because, you know, and it's just that general tension, that general stress is just socially so toxic. That people are feeling right now.
And I guess trust is a big thing here. People, we don't know who you are. We don't know if you're a teacher who's going to turn us in. So this is part of the sort of generalized omnipresence of fear.
Absolutely. And that's a huge thing. And then if you violate that trust, even in a very, very minor way, it takes forever to build it back up if you ever can. And that's the problem with fear, and that's the problem with the stress, and that's the problem with these areas is that it doesn't allow people to – it's at its core, it's dehumanizing because you're constantly on defense. We should be able to have, you know, these conversations and engage with each other and do all this stuff, but we're just not in a sociopolitical time where we can do that. And it gets even more difficult because there's some people who aren't really – adversely affected by Trump's policies, right? I mean, just north of here, there's a whole community that's really doing pretty well. And so then these issues become sort of an intellectual exercise. Well, what if we just let him build the wall? What if we did this and what if we did that? And it's like, people are going to die. And they're like, well, you don't have to yell at me. And I'm like, but you're being a jerk right now. Like, you're not considering the human impact. And for you, it's this kind of, forgive the crude term, but mental masturbation. You're not really thinking deeply about this issue and about the human costs that are occurring. You know, I'm just going to wear a MAGA hat because it's so cute, you know, make America great again. Do you know what kind of message that sends to the people around you? And then those very same people turn around and are like, why would people judge me for wearing a MAGA hat? Because MAGA represents racism. It represents sexism. It represents homophobia and transphobia, everything that is the core of the Trump administration. So, yes, if you're doing that, you deserve to be ridiculed. And don't sit there and pretend that you are the victim. You're the one who is going on offense by wearing that hat. They say, well, I have freedom of speech. Absolutely, you have freedom of speech. You have the freedom of speech to wear that hat, and I have the freedom of speech to say that you're an inhumane jerk for doing it.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it right there, Professor. But we appreciate you taking the time to be with us. You are an associate professor. You work with the Center for the Study of Higher Education, College of Education. We're here in Tucson, Arizona. And Professor Cabrera, we appreciate you taking the time out to be with us on Flashpoints.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And thanks for being here in Tucson.
Does it for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Kevin Pina and Miguel Gavilan Molina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, part one of a nice documentary film on the international so-called beauty industry, or how to get rich by making everybody in the world hate their bodies. I hope you'll stay tuned. New World Notes has looked at the beauty business before, with programs featuring critics Jean Kilburn and Rebecca Anshel Song. We'll hear from Kilburn again today, among others. Today we'll have part one of a recent documentary film on the beauty business, male and female. It's from 2015, written, directed, and produced by Elena Rossini. That's a new name to me, but she does very good work. The film is titled The Illusionists. One neat thing about The Illusionists is that it is international in scope. We'll hear from experts, and ordinary people too, in Boston, Paris, Milan, Beirut, Mumbai, and Tokyo. Plus a bunch of TV ads and video clips from around the world. The problems are global, not unique to the United States. The regional variations in beauty standards are interesting, though. The film doesn't use the term cultural imperialism, but that's part of the situation, too. The social status of the colonial people rises the more they look like their imperial colonizers. These foreign standards of beauty linger even after the empire packs up and goes home. As in India today. Or maybe the empire hasn't exactly packed up and gone home. Today's corporate ruling elite looks very much like last century's imperial elite. In any case, the beauty standards of the global rulers include pale skin, light hair, long legs, and slimness. Mixing with cultural imperialism are local beauty standards, which can be almost as hard for anyone to meet. So, in Japan, pale skin has long been highly desirable in women, to which are now added such Western features as round eyes, long legs, and skinniness. At least the Japanese still find straight black hair attractive. Not a peroxide blonde can be seen among all the Japanese girls and women the movie shows. Hey, Clairol, here's your next big opportunity to make some bucks. Here's a real stunning bit of information from the film. What country has the highest per capita rate of plastic surgery? No, it's not the United States. The answer is Lebanon. Here is another shocker, at least to a child of the 60s like me. Some studies show a surprisingly large number of young American men find female pubic hair disgusting. I don't know how well you can see me. I am shaking my head, half in sorrow, half in disbelief. Of course, more men are shaving off all of their body hair, too. That's a growing fad. Good news for Gillette, and whoever makes the male version of Brazilian bikini wax. As Melville's Bartleby the Scrivener famously said, I would prefer not to. But enough of me. On to our first installment of The Illusionists. Once again, the director is Elena Rossini. Lest you forget her name, in 1 minute, the film's first music will remind you. But the film starts with a brief lecture from the 1960s.
Well, there they are. Our new electronic media, or our new gadgets. You push a button, and the world's yours. You know how they talk about the world getting smaller? Well, it's thanks to these that it is. Everywhere is now our own neighborhood. But not only is the world getting smaller, it's becoming more available and more familiar to our minds and to our emotions. The world is now a global village. A global village.
We see the selling of the westernized image as the badge of modernity in India, in Singapore, in China, in Japan, where the notion of how you join globalized culture is the taking of a Western body.
There is one of those trends happening where we are trying to embody this westernized, modernized image because that's where power comes from. Power in society, power in the Western world, power in your job, power with your own beauty.
A black woman in Paris. Skin whitening, we call it scraping here, has become practically banal.
If you walk around the streets of Lebanon, I think you'd realize that most people look the same, specifically people from a certain social class that have the money to have this many surgeries.
Tokyo. Japanese women are under incredible pressure to have an ideal body, just like top models and manga characters. The problem is that the desire to look this way doesn't come from the women themselves. It's often imposed by society and the mass media.
I can remember when I was a high school student that body image was just not a concern. Nobody in those days worried about whether they had a six-pack of abdominal muscles or faithfully went to the gym 6 days a week. It just was not an issue when I was a teenager.
It's often seemed to me that a person who feels happy and secure isn't going to be a very good consumer, because that person isn't going to be looking for products to shore up the self-image or to feel better about oneself.
Part 1. Insecurity Sells. Jean Kilbourn.
Of course, there's nothing wrong with people wanting to look attractive and sexy. Just about everyone wants that. So the problem isn't the desire to be desired or the desire to be attractive and sexy. It's the ways in which this is corrupted and exploited by the commercial culture.
A recent study by Psychological Science has found that people spend more if they're feeling sad and self-focused, even when the sad feelings are temporary.
The ideal consumer is someone who's constantly dissatisfied, constantly needs more and more products in order to feel better. Actually, the ideal consumer is an addict, someone who has to have a product, and the product will never really meet the need, so the craving goes on and on and on and never ends.
Obsession. Obsession.
And for those consumers who already feel rather happy and secure, the industry has devised endless creative opportunities to feel otherwise. The best example is cellulite. It's an invented disease. Throughout history, cellulite was always considered perfectly normal body fat. The word cellulite actually appears for the first time in Vogue magazine in 1968 in a three-page article about this obnoxious condition that women were not aware of. And soon, a cottage industry of anti-cellulite creams is born. In 1987, Vogue warns American women that working in an office can damage their skin. Air particles found in an office can lead to what Vogue calls occupational dermatitis. In 2006, Vogue warns its readers about so-called aging feet.
One thing that I think most people don't realize is the extraordinary amount of power that advertisers have in terms of the content of the media. That people like to think that there's kind of a wall between editorial content and advertising, but in fact, there really isn't, and there's less and less of such a wall than ever before.
Our cameras are going to show you a non-surgical facelift live during our newscast.
A huge amount of the content that we get on the news is actually video news reports that are sponsored and paid for by corporations without the viewer being aware of it.
We're actually going to see four different non-invasive treatments during this hour. It's actually started. Kathy is our patient. Dermatologist Dr. Dale Isaacson is performing the procedure. The first one is thermage, which for the very first time could be done on the eyelids. Now, about 15 minutes before Dr. Isaacson started, Kathy had a Valium. Kathy, how are you feeling right now?
I feel absolutely fine.
Dieters have a new ally in the battle to lose weight.
Yeah, it's called Ally, the first FDA-approved over-the-counter weight loss drug, and it hits store shelves today.
From NBC News, this is a special age-defying edition of Today.
People sometimes say to me, well, women must want this because it's women who support these industries and women buy all these products. And so this must be something that advertisers are just giving people what they want. And the truth is, I think that women are deeply conditioned from birth to feel that what's most important about us is how we look, that our lovability, our desirability depends upon our appearance, our bodies. And if you believe that, and it's very difficult not to, of course you're going to be looking for products and you're going to be looking for fashion and you're going to be looking for things that will deliver the goods, that will make you more beautiful in the society sense of the word.
Harrison Pope, professor of psychiatry, Harvard Medical School.
The advertising industry has already saturated the female half of the population and has already done its best to convince women that they should be dissatisfied with themselves and should purchase a plethora of new products to make themselves more beautiful. And so now it seems that in the last 30 or 40 years, the advertising industry has now turned its sights on the other half of the population, hoping to find new markets. And if one can convince men that they are not muscular enough or lean enough or that their physiques are not adequate, you can perhaps generate yet another market of insecure individuals who will purchase various products in the hope of attaining greater beauty.
Part 2. The official body. Now, in our world news, can you guess which country has the most plastic surgery procedures per capita? Well, it's neither Brazil nor the United States. It's Lebanon. One in three women has had plastic surgery procedures. There are even special bank loans for plastic surgery.
We have the most plastic surgeries than anywhere else in the world. The interesting thing is that we're always competing with Brazil. So one year Lebanon's number one, one year is Brazil number one. In my theory, it's only because there's 12 million Lebanese living in Brazil that sort of, you know, are constantly competing about who has more plastic surgery operations. And there's tourism packages for people from other Arab countries to come to Lebanon and have plastic surgery procedures here. It's automatically been built into the economy, become an industry in itself.
Dr. Tony Nasser, cosmetic surgeon in Lebanon.
Every day I receive people, let's say from Kuwait, from Saudi Arabia, from France, from USA, from Canada. This year we have a big demand in the butt. I think the plastic surgery now, it entered in the culture of the country. And nowadays they talk about it freely. In the past, it was more closed and secret. Nowadays, the plastic surgery is the talk of the town, and it's a talk of every day. When two women meet each other, the first talk is the talk about beauty, about plastic surgery.
Sadly enough, actually, I grew up in a culture where people would be like, oh, you have a beautiful face, haram, haram your body, you should do something about your body. Some doctors would actually ask you, who would you like to look like? Everyone looks exactly the same.
Meher Meitzar, a Lebanese bank executive.
We used to receive 30 to 35 calls a day for the total of our products, so people asking about personal loans, housing loans, car loans, and the other products. And after launching plastic surgery campaign, we were receiving between 300 and 400 calls a day. In Lebanon, appearance is important to socialize. And in Lebanon, we really socialize a lot. People, they feel that it is important for their improvement in their career and in their life. To build up friends, to become more successful. That's why people are attaching more and more importance to appearance and to plastic surgery.
If you open any newspaper with classifieds where they're searching for jobs and they're searching for women, most of our jobs say must be beautiful. If they're good, they say must be presentable, but most of them say must be beautiful, must be good-looking, for jobs like accounting.
Psychotherapist Susie Orbach.
One of the tragedies that's happening at the moment is that we're losing bodies as fast as we're losing languages, just as English has become the lingua franca of the world. So the white, blondified, small-nosed, perp-breast, long-legged body is coming to stand in for the great variety of human bodies that there are.
black and white.
Mumbai, India's biggest city and the country's commercial and entertainment capital. Strolling through its streets, it's hard to miss the ubiquitous messages advertising skin whitening products. White beauty, fair and lovely, perfect white. The market for fairness creams has had an explosive growth since the 1970s. But the desire to have light skin has deeper roots.
Most Indians still have internalized racism, where the Western body image is definitely more superior. Because remember, India is an ex-colony of the British, where we've always had this fascination for the white man or the white woman and how she looks. So there is, I think, one of those trends happening where we are trying to embody this westernized, modernized image, because that's where power comes from. I mean, when you say fair, it's all relative. North Indian women are lighter skinned than South Indian women for most part. But everybody is trying to aim at the light skin. So the North Indian woman who's already got a lighter skin is aiming at being as light as the British colonial woman or the American woman that she sees on TV or a white model. It's unattainable. That's when you go out and seek products that are extremely dangerous, because there's no way that you can sort of change the color of your skin. That's what you're born with. Why don't we just accept that brown is beautiful or black is beautiful?
The market for skin whitening creams is so lucrative that there are about 50 new products introduced in the Asia-Pacific region every year.
Go sleeveless on him with fairer, whiter underarms.
Pharmaceutical company Midas Care has recently caused an uproar with its skin-whitening intimate wash, promising to make women's genitals whiter. The possibilities are endless for making Indian women insecure about their skin tone. And nowadays, there is a new target.
So you have, for instance, you know, cream that was targeting women for the longest time called Fair and Lovely. There's a counterpart for the men now. It's called Fair and Handsome, and that's Emami that launched it in 2005. With exactly the same sort of reasoning, is that, all right, you have it all. You're male, so vis-a-vis the women, you already have the power, but vis-a-vis the white man, you're probably still not as well off. So if you want to go that notch up into the power hierarchy, you know, being fair might help. And so whether it's for a job or whether it's for matchmaking or whether it's for appearing as more westernized, modernized, sometimes what the West calls civilized, it helps to be whiter.
We can also find skin whitening messages in the most unexpected places.
Paris. Paola Audrey Ndengwe, the editor of the magazine Fashion Black. The use of skin whitening creams, unfortunately, is really common in Africa. I mention Africa because the vast majority who use these creams here come from the diaspora and have been brought up in a culture where skin whitening, we call it scraping, is so common it's practically banal. So here in France, I think it is unfortunately a common practice. Even though very few people talk about it, it's totally taboo. Skin whitening is so common here that the authorities had to intervene. They banned the sales of products that contain hydroquinone, one of the key ingredients, which can be very dangerous. Despite the ban, all you have to do is go to the neighborhood Les Galettes d'Or, and you can still buy these creams. I think that advertising and the mass media have played a role in this. Everywhere you see black women who are not too black, so they can be accepted by mainstream media. The most prominent women in entertainment today are all fair-skinned and have a huge influence, even on black women who live abroad, like here in Europe.
An influence considerable, même pour les femmes noires issues d'autres pays et qui sont notamment en France.
L'Oréal, the world's biggest cosmetics company, has run into trouble with an ad for hair color featuring the singer Beyoncé, who is virtually unrecognizable. L'Oreal has vehemently denied altering Beyoncé's complexion. Yet what's interesting is to notice the many faces of Beyoncé in the company's ads over the years.
Several magazine ads featuring Beyoncé are shown. In the most recent ad, Beyoncé's skin is much lighter in color than in the earlier ads.
The idealization of a fair skin tone is not always a black and white issue. Porcelain white skin has been valued in many parts of Asia for centuries. It's seen as synonymous with youth, elegance, and refinement, a trend that beauty companies have been quick to cash in on. Japan breaks all records when it comes to consumption of skincare products. Women use on average 7 to 10 products a day. Afraid of the sun's effect on skin aging, many women use umbrellas to shield themselves from the sun's rays. Having a porcelain white skin, free of blemishes and beauty spots, is the ultimate beauty ideal in Japan.
In Japan, we have a proverb that says, a white complexion hides all flaws. I mean that even if you're not attractive, having white skin makes you beautiful. Traditionally, the Japanese have always valued white skin.
The irony is that while pushing white skin in the East, these same companies tell you to avoid it at all cost in the West. They sell skin whitening creams in half of the world and self-tanning lotions in the other. Clearly, they don't care what color your skin is, as long as you are insecure about it. The ideal is often impossible to achieve, but the illusion is that this beauty can be bought if only people keep consuming.
And here we must pause the first installment of The Illusionists, written and directed by Elena Rossini. Yes, thank you. I won't forget. We'll hear the rest of the film in the next two installments of New World Notes. Shakespeare has a nice poem on impossible standards of female beauty. Impossible standards celebrated by starry-eyed poets and such. It's sonnet number 130. My mistress' eyes are nothing like the sun. Coral is far more red than her lips red. If snow be white, why then her breasts are dun. If hair be wires, black wires grow on her head. I have seen roses damasked red and white, but no such roses see I in her cheeks. And in some perfumes there is more delight than in the breath that from my mistress reeks. I love to hear her speak, yet well I know that music hath a far more pleasing sound. I grant I never saw a goddess go. My mistress, when she walks, treads on the ground. And yet, by heaven, I think my love as rare as any she belie with false compare. If you miss any weekly installment of our show, you can find it on our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, reminding you that you're not crazy, the system is, advising illegitimate non-carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Till then. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
I'm joined on the show today by Frank Tolupko. Frank is a 9/11 researcher and a former radio show host in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Frank, welcome to the show today.
Always good to be here and talk about all things political.
The topic that we're going to discuss today would be laughable if the consequences weren't so serious. It's propaganda at its best. And before we get started, I just want to mention that I was not and am not a supporter of Hillary or Trump. I believe that both parties, at the federal level at least, are both controlled by the deep state, and Hillary and Trump are just puppets. And to me, it looks like we have two parts of the deep state in conflict with each other. So having said that, let's begin by letting Rachel Maddow introduce the topic of today's show. So here she is, Rachel Maddow.
Vladimir Putin, Russia, 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 Russia hates Russia, 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 Putin, Russia's Russia, 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 Russian, 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 Russia, Russia, Moscow, Moscow, Russia, Russian, pro-Russian, Russian, Russia, Russian, 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 the Russians, Russian, 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 Russians, Russians, Russia, Russians, Russian, 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 Russia, Russian, 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 Moscow, Russian, Russian, Russia, Putin, Russian, 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 Russian against us, Russians, Russians, Russia against the U.S., the Russians, Russia, Russia, Russian, Russian, Russian government scheme, the Russians, Vladimir Putin, Russia, Vladimir Putin, Russia, Putin, Putin and Russia, Russia, Moscow, Russia, Russian, Russian, Russia, the Russians, Russian, Russians, Russia, Russia, Russian, Russian, Russia, Russia, Putin, 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 Russian, 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 Russia, the Soviet Empire, the second of the 20th century's great evils, communism, Russia,
communism,
Russia, assault by Russia, 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 Russia's,
Russia, Russia, Putin despises the West in general and the United States in particular, the Soviet Empire, Russia,
Russia, Russia,
they're the adversary, they want to bring us down, the Soviet Union.
You've just heard outtakes from the March 9th, 2018 Rachel Maddow show, which obviously was about all what we would call Russiagate at that point. Very interestingly, Rachel Maddow is the one that kept saying Bernie, Bernie, Bernie during the primary season. And like in, after three-day meeting, she turned around and kept saying Hillary, Hillary, Hillary. So it's she's somebody that could obviously be bought. And for making $7 million a year, she's doing her job pretty well.
Yeah, so it's clear that Operation Mockingbird, which is the CIA's plan to infiltrate the media, has been completely successful. The whole media attack on Russia reminds me a lot of the media's omissions and distortions concerning 9/11. And luckily, this propaganda about Russia is not having the desired effect that the powers that be hoped it would. And now we're going to hear from Jimmy Dore explaining that from a recent poll.
There are a number of polls that he quotes that's actually emboldening many of the policies that, that people find abhorrent. Some don't, some do, but they find it abhorrent.
So here he is, Jimmy Dore.
And I just want to let you know, all that propaganda being pushed by the mainstream news and the establishment press and Rachel Maddow specifically, you know what the result of that is? If you go to my computer, the Gallup just did a poll. Less than 1% of Americans believe Russia is a top problem. Less than 1% of Americans. So when I say this on the show that no one in America cares about this, I'm not making it up. I actually travel to parts of the country, and I know that no one cares about this stuff, right? So this is a completely made-up propaganda. And I'll just show you a little bit from this Gallup poll. It says less than 1% of Americans consider the situation with Russia a top problem for the United States, according to a Gallup poll released on July 18th. The number of Americans who consider Russia to be the biggest problem facing the country has not surpassed 1% in any of the past 7 months, the pollster found. while major news outlets have relentlessly pushed the Russian interference narrative for nearly 2 years, Americans remain overwhelmingly more concerned about domestic issues, with concerns about immigration and the government topping the list of the biggest problems. The lack of proof and the negligible concern from Americans on Russia issue may be contributing to, get this, to President Donald Trump's resilience in presidential approval polls. In 2018, Trump's approval rating has tracked closely to that of President Obama's during his first term, according to Rasmussen Reports, the pollster that was most accurate in predicting the outcome of the 2016 presidential election. The survey conducted last week as Trump concluded an international trip by meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Helsinki showed those controversies haven't yet harmed his overall popularity. The 45% who approved of his job performance compared with 52% who disapproved represent a slight uptick since June. That brings Trump's popularity more in line with those of his Oval Office predecessors after he recorded historic lows for a new president in 2017. One major asset for Trump, by 50% to 34%, voters approve his handling of the strong economy. So what I'm going to tell you is what Rachel Maddow is doing is actually hurting our country. She's actually doing what she's saying Putin and Russia is doing to our country. Rachel Maddow is hurting our country and hurting our chances to replace Donald Trump with a social democratic leader. That's what she's doing. She's actually helping Trump. That's what the polls show. That's what the data shows. And even her own viewers aren't buying that Russia is a problem. They're watching that like porn. Like people used to watch Sean Hannity when he would talk about long-form birth certificates. That's how people watch Rachel Maddow. And that's how crazy it's gotten.
And not only do the powers that be control the news media, they also have people they can call on to write books promoting their lies and disinformation. One that comes to mind concerning 9/11 was the Anthony Summers and Robin Swan's book called The 11th Day, The Full Story of 9/11, which was anything but the full story. And similarly, concerning Russiagate is the book I just finished reading called Russian Roulette, The Inside Story of Putin's War on America and the Election of Donald Trump. Frequently in this book, they give you all these supposedly facts about, you know, the Russian interference, and then they have to state that there's only a 50% chance that it's true. And, you know, most of the information, quote, evidence concerning Russiagate comes from a secret source in Moscow who gave the information to a former British spy, the Mr. Christopher Steele. So a lot of it is based on this secret guy who we don't know who he is in Russia. But first, let's get some more background information from former CIA analyst and founding member of Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, speaking on this issue in 2017. Here he is, Ray McGovern.
I put myself in Vladimir Putin's chair here. Okay, I'm sitting here and I'm looking at my advisors and I say, wow, this campaign is really amazing, this American political campaign. Well, we have a guy who not only is unpredictable, but he, my God, he's proud of it. He brags about being unpredictable and he lashes out. He's very emotional. He lashes out at any insult or any slight perceived or imagined. This is, hey guys, around the Kremlin table there. This is precise. This is a wonderful. This is exactly the kind of guy I like to have to deal with as head of the United States of America. Give me a break. This is the guy Putin wanted to have his finger on the nuclear codes. You know, so if you set up the premise that Putin and his associates had a distinct preference for Trump over Hillary Clinton, if I dispute that as I do, and we're seeing it play it out right, I talk about unpredictability, talk about lashing out, that's what Trump is. So unless Putin thinks about the world in a way that no other Russian or Soviet leader that I know has, and unless he was clairvoyant in seeing that Trump was going to win, there's no reason in the whole world that he would have hacked into the DNC computers. Not only that, but the expertise that we have in veteran intelligence professionals for sanity won't quit. We've got four very senior members of the National Security Agency, one of whom, Bill Binney, actually devised the collection systems that they're using now to collect emails and telephone calls. And he's looked at all this and he said, Ray, if this was a hack, NSA would know exactly who hacked it and where it was sent. They have ironclad coverage of the whole internet. So a hack has to be sent over the system, over the network. The NSA would certainly have intercepted it. It's not a hack. It's a leak. I said, well, what's the difference, Bill? He said, well, a leak, you take a thumb drive, you stick it in a computer, you download. That's what Bradley or Chelsea Manning did. And that's what many people have done. What's his name? Snowden did it that way. So we have a leak, and that's why the President of the United States had to admit 2 days before he left office, as he put it, quote, the conclusions of the intelligence community with respect to how this Russian hacking got to WikiLeaks are inconclusive, the president's word. Okay, so what does that mean? That means the United States government doesn't know how to support their charge that whatever hacking happened by the Russians, how it got to WikiLeaks. That's a pretty profound gap in their information. And of course, the reason is it wasn't hacked. It was leaked. It was leaked by somebody, we think, within the Democratic National Committee, who was aghast when he or she saw the way Hillary Clinton stole the election, the nomination from Bernie Sanders. I mean, the whole thing, if you look at the content of those emails, you'll see that it was gross. Otherwise, why did Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the other top four people from the DNC quit immediately? So the whole campaign since that time, which was 2 days before the Democratic National Convention, Hillary and her friends had a real problem. What do they do with the fact that WikiLeaks has leaked all these DNC emails? Was there a sort of a gloss on it? No, they were documents, okay? Nobody disputed the authenticity of these documents. So what's she going to do? Somebody says, well, gosh, oh, I know. We'll blame it on the Russians. And somebody else said, well, but this isn't the Russians. This is Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. No problem. We'll say that WikiLeaks working. Yes, we'll say we're working for the Russians. Yeah, but what's the rationale? Oh, come on. The rationale is Vladimir Putin would certainly prefer to deal with Donald Trump than with Hillary Clinton. Now, that's the way that went it down. I talked to the head of Hillary Clinton's communications. She was the communications director, and she talked about how hard she worked at the convention to keep the focus on the Russians and not to let anybody even think about the content of those emails, which I have to say again, pure and simple, showed how Bernie Sanders was cheated out of the nomination. So it worked like a charm. And now that they've lost, then they have to explain how Hillary, who was a shoo-in, how she possibly could have been a flawed candidate. Well, she wasn't flawed. No, it was the Russians again. So, you know, if it weren't so pernicious, if it weren't so much added or aimed not only at explaining why Hillary lost, but also at sabotaging any effort by Trump or anybody else to make a deal with the Russians, to have a decent relationship with the Russians, well, if we weren't so serious, then we could laugh at it.
You've just heard Ray McGovern speaking back in 2017 when all this Russian stuff started up. The Russians are coming. Ray McGovern, as mentioned, was a founding member of the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, talking about the improbable logic of why Putin and the Russians, etc., would want Trump to be elected with his unpredictability, etc. And if, in fact, they had hacked us, as he quotes William Binney, who was also a member of the same VIPS organization, quoting him, saying, if they hacked it, we would have known because we control everything. Everything in the world in the Internet comes through servers in the United States. I've done some research on this. We control the naming of sites. We control all traffic that goes through there. We would have known about that. We control Tor. We control a lot of other things.
And isn't there evidence that we also created WikiLeaks, that WikiLeaks is maybe not an independent organization?
That's another show.
Yeah,
it's a very interesting thing. Yeah. And in many cases, like the Pentagon Papers may have been a distraction also from what the CIA was doing and with the Operation Phoenix there. In other words, it was a limited hangout. But that, again, another show. So why don't we hear what William Binney, jumping forward to August of 2018, speaking and being interviewed by Jimmy Dore, talking about the Mueller indictments and their validity.
Yes, former NSA whistleblower William Binney. Here he is.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Jimmy Dore Show. We have a special guest with us. It's Bill Binney. You know him. He's been on the show before. He's an intelligence officer turned whistleblower who resigned from the NSA in 2001 after nearly 30 years with the agency. And since then, he's continued doing his own research elsewhere and has been correcting misinformation put out there by the intelligence agencies, especially in regards to WMDs and Russiagate. And today we're talking with him about the most recent occurrences. Please welcome back to the show. It's Bill Binney. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Jimmy. Thanks for having me back.
So some people were telling me that you had been reversing some of your conclusions about the alleged Russian hack of the DNC servers because there was some new Guccifer data that turned out to be falsified. Could you explain what's going on with that and what your new position is, if there is one?
Well, the only thing that's different with that new data, the fact is that the data went like this. There's Guccifer 2 or somebody representing him put the data out on the web for people to look at. That was a download he claimed that came across on the 5th of July, and another download he claimed came across on the 1st of September of 2016. But if you looked at that data a little closer and you ignored the hour and the day and just looked at minutes, seconds, and milliseconds, you could take those two data sets and shuffle them like a deck of cards, and they fit together into one data set without conflict. So in other words, where the holes were in the other one, in one of the files, the other file fit in. So it was one continuous set of data. So that meant that Guccifer 2 was playing with the data. He did one download, split it into two files, and claimed he made two different hacks. I guess to say, basically saying the second hack occurred after you knew the first one did, and see, I can do anything, you can't stop me. I mean, that's my assumption. But the point is, those two files merged, and that means it's only one file, and Guccifer 2 totally is a fabrication. So that meant everything that he claimed had to be proven. First of all, by the speed, the download speeds, which were compatible with a thumb drive, but couldn't be accommodated by the net going across to Russia, across the Atlantic, or anywhere in Europe, really.
So you still stand by that statement?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Okay.
The only thing that's different is we can't say that it came down from the DNC. All we know is it's a fabrication. That means you've got to prove everything that Guccifer 2 says he's representing there,
and
including
so,
the timestamps, where it was done. We can prove forensically it was done locally. It was not a hack. We just don't know where local is. That's the only thing that's changed. The DNC is not there. We can't say it was done there.
And the reason why this is important, that this Guccifer had fabricated data, is because, correct me if I'm wrong, did Rosenstein and Mueller rely on that data when they did their indictments?
Yes, that's right. That's right up front in the indictment. The DC leaks and also Guccifer 2 are the main sets of evidence he's using. I mean, he's basing it on a fabrication. So his indictment is a fabrication. I would also point out, Jimmy, if you look, he claimed that this was proof that the Russians, the GRU, meddled in our voting and elections. But if you looked at all the laws that he's charging them with violations, the crimes were all under Code 18 codes, which are the standard criminal codes. The codes for voting and election crimes are all under 52 U.S. codes. The main one that I looked at was 10308, which covers all the crimes governing elections and voting. And he doesn't have one of those in there. There's not one. They're not charged with that.
And so what does that tell you?
It tells me he's charging spies with being spies. In other words, it means the Russian GRU is hacking everybody to get information. Well, that's what we do, too.
Yeah.
So he's charging them for hacking, which means that we should expect all of our spies to be charged with the similar crimes by all the other countries in the world, because we do more spying and hacking than anybody.
So to me, I that's exactly what I thought about this whole thing. It's like you're making an announcement that you had these Russian spies trying to hack into some electronic data in the United States. And I'm like, well, I'm sure we're doing the same thing back to them. I mean, I know we had a tap on Angela Merkel's phone. I mean, we're spying on everybody. So what they're doing is they're taking stuff that is natural, matter of course stuff that spies do on a daily basis, and they're pretending like it's special, right?
That's right.
And so
that's exactly right.
To me, that's propaganda then, right? So
the whole thing was to interfere with the meeting in Helsinki.
So
that's basically what it was all about.
So when Chuck Schumer was on Rachel Maddow's show, Chuck Schumer warned Donald Trump not to mess with the intelligence community. And what he said was, I would not mess with the intelligence community because the intelligence community has six ways to Sunday to mess with you back. So now my question to you, do you think that the timing of this, what we consider to be a completely bogus indictment because it's based on fraudulent data and it just talks about normal spy stuff. So do you think that the timing of this indictment was to screw with Trump and to undermine his meeting in Helsinki?
Well, I think that's absolutely the case. Yeah. The timing is just too convenient for them.
Right.
You know, it was to take away, to try to focus attention elsewhere on by the American public. This is the whole idea of the intelligence community. They're trying to control the narrative that goes across the mainstream media and how people get their information and what information they get. I mean, even the companies are lining up with them to filter and censor people who aren't conforming to the general narrative that's acceptable by the government. I mean, you can see that with the Facebook blocking people and blocking information. And it's just a continuation of that. I think it was one of the directors of Central Intelligence who said they've been trying to infiltrate the mainstream media for decades. And he said, well, you'll know we've succeeded once most of what is believed is false.
Yes, I've seen that quote myself. Yeah. So what I was going to say to you, you know, so you're saying the intelligence community is trying to control the narrative on this Russiagate thing. And this indictment right before the Helsinki meeting with Putin, this was to undermine that and to control the narrative. And let me just say to you, it seems to be working like a charm, is it not?
It is. Yes. But it's even worse than that, though, Jimmy. This is what I told Director Pompeo when I met with him at the CIA. I said, your intelligence agencies are lying to you and the president and to this government. Really? And they're not telling you the truth. It's like, how do you get into weapons of mass destruction, slam dunk? That's a lie. Look at, you know, these are all lies. They're not spying on U.S. citizens. That's a lie. Not spying on Congress. That's a lie. Brennan was doing it he got caught at it. That was the point. Spying on the Senate Intelligence Committee, doing their report on CIA torture.
Right.
So this is a whole series of lies. And they are just trying to manipulate the entire government. This is why I call them the Praetorian Guard. You know, they want to determine who the emperor is and what the emperor does.
So what is it that they want Trump to do? It seems like he's doing their bidding. The military industrial complex seems to be humming right along. They increased the budget even. So, and he's bombing in Yemen. He's doing the bidding of Israel and Saudi Arabia.
Yep.
So what is it that he's not doing that they want him to do? Is it still Syria?
No. The new thing is Russia, 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 a new Cold War. That means a few more trillions of dollars into the coffers. That's the big swindle.
So this is just to reignite a Cold War so we can up the military spending permanently. That's all this is.
That's it.
So this is exactly what Eisenhower warned us against, correct?
Yes, it is. And I was saying behind the shadow government, which is what this is, all the agencies and so on getting together, is the deep state. That's the military industrial intelligence complex. And all the banking is a part of that. And even the technology people are now part of that, too. All the Internet service providers and the telecommunications companies are part of it. So, you know, this is deep state that's driving the money push for money, more and more money to make more and more contracts from government, more and more control. I keep saying this whole thing boils down to three words, power, control, and money. And that's what's been governing the way people act internally in the agencies. I mean, they even lie within the agencies to manipulate and move money around, and they lie from agency to agency to get the one agency gets up above or has an advantage over another, and therefore can say, I need more money, you know, And even within the government, the people in Congress are giving out money according to how many people put some military base or some kind of a facility that brings money into their constituents area. So in the next, so they can say, we brought this in here, and now you get more jobs, more everything here. So we're helping out our community here. So reelect me. You know, that's the whole point. That's how it spins up, you know?
Yeah. Yes. Boy, this is super depressing because it doesn't seem like it's going to go away. And it doesn't seem like the people who could, like, there's no reporter at the New York Times that's going to write a story that's going to talk about what you're talking about right now. There's no host at MSNBC who's going to actually tell the truth about this Russiagate investigation. Are you surprised at that?
And no, because for me, and from what I've seen, is they've successfully been infiltrated and threatened by the shadow government. It's just like Schumer warned, they're threatened too.
Oh, no kidding. So you think people like Rachel Maddow and Chris Hayes and Lawrence O'Donnell, they're also threatened?
Oh, indirectly, yeah. I mean, they're afraid of them too. I mean, that's why I shared the diagram of all the tap points for the Fairview program that NSA has. That's AT&T's tap points. And it goes right across the country, you know? But I can't get any mainstream media to show it on television because then people would see this is an obvious lie that they're after foreigners. They're after us, you know, and those tap points show that. It's not, I mean, they're afraid to show anything that isn't amenable to the line from the intelligence agencies and the general narrative out of the government.
So what we have here is the claim by NSA whistleblower William Binney saying that the Mueller indictments came out just a few days before the meeting in Helsinki between President Trump and Vladimir Putin. Not that I'm a fan of either of those guys, but they were attempting perhaps to get some sort of rapprochement, which would not be very good for the military-industrial complex and showing that there's a threat out there and we have to have more weapons. The more things change, the more they stay the same. President Eisenhower, who warned about the military-industrial complex, had the same thing done to him because he was supposed to meet in Vienna with Nikita Khrushchev, again, for about rapprochement of some sort of agreement about what was going on in the Central and Eastern Europe. And just before that, you had the whole U-2 incident, the American spy plane being shot down over the Soviet Union and then creating the whole furor and essentially derricking the talk. So the more things change, stay the same.
And then we have JFK, who was actually in secret communication with Khrushchev.
And the Cubans.
And he was also threatening the CIA, and we know what happened to him.
So who's really calling the shots?
Yes, that's the question. And, you know, I knew the day before the election that Trump was going to win because I read, and I can't remember where I read it now, but I read a small article about how the Hillary campaign had canceled the celebratory fireworks over New York City scheduled for election night. I read that, and I said to myself, wow, the fix is in for Trump. And lastly today, the leaker from the DNC that Bill Binney talked about may have been Seth Rich, who was murdered in Washington, D.C., and we were told the motive was robbery, but the thieves didn't take his wallet or any money he had on him. Perhaps they stole his thumb drive. Anyway, if I were investigating it, that's where I'd look. Frank, thank you for being on the show today.
Great. It was a pleasure.
This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Power to the people. Power to the people. Right on.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Women march and rally in New York. It's not about charismatic leaders, but building charismatic movements.
Even freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes.
Until the killing of black men, black mothers, sons, is as important.
Sweet Honey and the Rock are going to take us into our next segment, but not before we hear Stacey Ann Chen. You know, a social understanding of the real social conditions existing across race, gender, and class isn't just important because it fills an important gap and misreadings, but also because it gives us the knowledge that we need if we are to bring people and movements together and avoid repeating our divide and conquer history. And no matter what happens next with the Women's March, its impact has been undeniable and its seeds rooted to build movement. So we do segue from rhythms of Sweet Honey and the Rock, We Who Believe in Freedom Cannot Rest, to the power of spoken word artist Stacey Ann Chen to let these women usher in some of the most powerful and energizing voices of sisters and struggle and for empowerment from the Women's March 2019 at Foley Square, where we shivered and hugged together on the road towards our self-determination and empowerment. The Women's March movement really was the birthplace of a resistance movement. Stacey Ann Chen, tell it like it is.
It must be in the water being force-fed to the police. They must also be feeding it to the prosecutor and the politicians, who obviously care nothing about the staccato of black bodies falling like leaves in Ferguson, in Cleveland, December in New York, and the world has lost its mind. Christmas trees being erected like dicks amidst a groundswell of Bill Cosby accusers coming out of the closet of secrecy, synchronizing with stories about frat boys growing up rapists. All this as the national justice system wraps up pretty colored presentations to grand juries who collectively refuse to indict murderers captured on video, set free by unpopular opinions that overwhelm the evidence available to anyone with a cellular phone. I am holding my own sorrow for my own little girl, born black, in a country in which her brown body does not matter to anyone with any power. Being woman and black is hard in this topsy-turvy world where men are created equal when they are white and heterosexual. I am watching these murderers on repeat, the helpless bile rising angry in my chest. I am not feeling forgiving today. It is time for these oppressors to turn their cheeks to the countless victims. These public killings are the modern-day lynchings. These events amount to war against the poor. This is not a video game. Those murdered men and women are not dominoes. These dead children belonged to parents who now mourn them without closure, without a day in court. We are moving backwards through history. Foolish as it might have been, we the people had swallowed the fallacy that trumpeted the end of a time when black mothers who lost children to white arrogance had no recourse. We believed our lives removed from that shameful time that supposedly ended with Emmett Till and Herbert Lee and Medgar Evers and Harriet Moore and Malcolm X. Back then, there was no hypocrisy about the system being stacked against anyone with a smidgen of melanin staining the history of their skin. 50 years after the Black Civil Rights Movement, we are still not protected by the law. This is not what we voted for when we voted our first black president. This is not what our freedom fighters hoped for when they marched against segregation in Selma and Chicago and Birmingham and Montgomery. This is not the dream Dr. Martin Luther King died for in Memphis, Tennessee. 50 years later, race relations in America is cauldron bubbling angry under the ugly swirl of black despair and a lack of white accountability parading as a penal system in which 40% of those incarcerated come from a group which consists only 12% of the entire population. With numbers like that, what good does it do to comply with those in uniform? Shot at 12 for holding a toy gun. Strangled in an illegal chokehold for selling loose cigarettes. Arrested without cause for being too black or too loud or too much her own woman. These incidents filmed for the families to watch these murders played out on primetime TV. A system sworn to protect us owes us something when it fails. A system sworn to protect us owes us something when it fails. And when we deign to speak out against this system, we should speak in solidarity. Our sorrow must be one. Our rage must be one. With one voice, we have to call out the names of the dead, claim them as each our own. We must continue to say these names: Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice, Michael Brown, Sean Bell, Yvette Smith, Sandra Bland. Could have been any one of us seated here this evening. Victims all silenced by state-sanctioned executions. We have to find the courage to rise up. Even though it's frightening, we have to find the courage to rise up. For them, for ourselves, for our children's children. It is time to raise more than our eyebrows in protest. It is time to put your body where you say your politics lie. This is not a moment to invoke a sweet by and by. This is a moment for action. This is a moment for civil disobedience. If there is any humanity left in you, get up! Stand up! Join a protest! Pick up your pen, write, scream, wail, march, meet, gather. We have to strategize. It is time to raise more than the roof on these. It's time for America to come to terms with a permanent fact of our black bodies. No matter what you do to our flesh, no matter how long you wage war against our spirit, we as a culture, as a people, we remain a force of resistance to the proliferation of white supremacy. No matter where you come from, no matter how you got here, inside these brutal walls of these United States of America, white power must always meet fire when they meet us. Inside the walls of this United States of America, white power must always meet fire when they meet us. Get used to us, white people. Learn to live alongside us. Make a decision to do right by us. Do it willingly, or unwillingly. We don't f-ing care. You white liberals in the audience, you have to find the words to speak to these white racists. You have to convince them to get with the program, because our black asses are never, ever, ever going away.
We who believe in freedom will not rest. Stacey Ann Chen, who, along with Sweet Honey and the Rock, usher us into the rest of the incredible experience I had, not about charismatic leaders, but charismatic sisters, women moving forward, because the Women's March really was the birthplace of a resistance movement. Now to Foley Square and highlights of the warmth, the rigor, the movement building process for self-determination and empowerment.
Greetings! Solidarity! Power! Women! Girls! Femmes! All! My name is Roz Pachesky. I'm from Jewish Voice for Peace. It's my great pleasure to introduce my dear friend and JVP sister, Esther Farmer. Esther defies conventional stereotypes and binaries. She is both Jewish and Palestinian. For some 30 years, she's been using theater as a tool for community development, even while she worked at the New York City Housing Authority. For us in JVP, Esther is an inspiration, a brilliant and charismatic leader who has taught us many skills for building radical social justice activism through relationships, care, and love. Her decades of activism in anti-racist and Puerto Rican solidarity movements and struggles are interwoven with her commitment to Palestinian liberation. And she's a real artist. Esther has brought to JVP's local and national work a dynamic theater storytelling project. Storytelling, stories, she's always telling us, tell your stories. And especially having an impact about Zionism, about Jews, about Palestinians. With her team, she's bringing the original theater piece, Wrestling with Zionism, to neighborhood audiences throughout New York and the whole metropolitan area. She's changing hearts and minds. Welcome, Esther Farmer.
Yes, I am a Palestinian Jew. I am so thrilled to say that I belong at this march. What we see today is the real power of solidarity. The powers that be will always try to divide us. But we are not having it this time. We as Jews and as Palestinians know from our history the importance of solidarity. And at Jewish Voice for Peace, our slogan is, we are Jews for justice, not just us. That's the spirit that we are embodying today. None of us here standing in the cold are here only for us, because we know that, as Emma Lazarus said, none of us are free until all of us are free. And that means we need to show up for each other, because from one colonial border to another, our oppressors are certainly colluding. The tear gas that the U.S. government uses to attack migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border is the same tear gas Israel uses against Palestinian protesters in Gaza. Showing up for each other is what real safety means. It means we will support immigrants under severe threat. It means we will not allow for any of us to be attacked and demonized. It means that we stand with women of color and support their leadership. And it means that as we build this movement, we embody that spirit of solidarity in our organizing, in how we work together, and even in how we talk to each other. That's the kind of culture that will make people want to be a part of this movement, and that's what this day is all about. Thank you.
I am here to introduce Margarita Vasquez. She is a member of Unite Here Local 100. And she works at Sky Chef, where the majority of workers are women. I'm so proud to introduce Margarita Vasquez.
Se puede! Se puede! Si se puede! Si se puede! Si se puede! Si se puede!
Mi nombre es Margarita Vasquez. Soy miembro de United Head Local 100. Yo trabajo en Sky Chef en la industria de preparación de comidas para las aerolíneas del aeropuerto JFK.
My name is Margarita Vasquez and I'm a member of United Head Local 100. I work for Sky Chef in the airline catering industry for JFK Airport.
Kaiser es una de las compañías más grandes en los Estados Unidos de preparación de comidas. Sky Chef ganó miles de millones de ganancias este año pasado.
Sky Chef is one of the largest airline catering companies in the United States. Sky Chef made billions in profit last year.
El plan de seguro de salud de Sky Chef cuesta $200 al mes para una sola familia. Demasiado caro para el sueldo que tan bajo ganamos en nuestro departamento. Dependemos de Medicaid, unos queremos sin seguro. Ninguno tiene seguro médico.
Sky Chef health insurance plans cost almost $200 per month for a family. Too expensive for the low salary we earn. Many of us depends on Medicaid or go out with insurance.
Nuestro trabajo es duro, especialmente considerando que la industria de preparación de comida para aerolíneas es predominante, compuesto de mujeres luchadoras. Trabajamos en lugares fríos de congelación. Operamos lavando platos industriales. Salimos a la calle en todas las condiciones climáticas. Nos enfermamos y lesionamos en el trabajo. Todo para asegurarnos que los pasajeros de Sky Chef estén tiempo con sus vuelos.
Our work is hard, especially considering that the airline industry is predominantly composed of women. Women fighters. We work in freezing cold, operate in industrial dishwashers and go out on tarmac in all weather conditions.
Nos sentimos orgullosos de nuestro arduo trabajo, pero estamos hartos. Queremos poder apoyar a nuestras familias con dignidad. Es hora que Sky Chef nos muestre el respeto que merecemos. El 2019 es el año en que vamos a cambiar nuestra vida. ¡Sí se puede! ¡Sí se puede! ¡Sí se puede!
Sasha to show us the respect we deserve. 2019 is the year in which we are going to get to change our lives. Yes, we can!
I'm Shirley Alderon. I am Vice President of SEIU Local 32BJ. Our people are suffering because Donald Trump wants to build a wall. Because Donald Trump wants to attack immigrant people, hardworking people, communities of color, women. We want Donald Trump to end the shutdown now. If this goes on much longer, we are going to continue to go without programs that we all need in our union. 32BJ, hundreds and hundreds of workers are affected, whether they are cleaning offices or securing federal buildings. With me today is a very strong woman who protects the public but has seen her life disrupted by the shutdown. Michelle Oviedo is a security officer who works for a contractor hired by the federal government. Trump and the Republicans forced Michelle to hustle to provide for her family. Michelle is a mother of three and is standing up strong, speaking out loudly, telling Trump, reopen our government, reopen it now. Michelle.
Immigrants, my neighbors are immigrants. I work for the Smithsonian Museum, one of the hundreds of sites across the country that is currently impacted by the government's shutdown. My co-workers and I work for a government contract, and we effectively pay wages when this government shutdown ends. We don't know when this craziness will end and when we will be able to pay off the bills and expenses that are piling up during the president's shutdown. We are here today to reject hate and embrace love for women, for workers, for immigrants, and for our neighbors, and for our fellow human beings. We want to fight to make America a better nation for all of us. To do that, we need to build bridges to connect us, not a wall that divides us. Mr. Trump, Mitch McConnell, Republicans, end the shutdown now and reopen our government. This government shutdown is a double attack. It's an attack on the hardworking men and women like me and my co-workers who keep our government running every day. It is also an attack on immigrants like me, my family, friends, and neighbors, because you shut down the government to force Congress to give you money to build a wall to keep people like me out of the U.S. So I took it personally when the president shut down the government because he can't get money for a wall to keep my family, my friends, and my neighbors out of the country we call home. It's a symbol that we don't trust and don't want people from Mexico, Central America. No, we don't want their wall of hate, their wall of fear. This is hurting all Americans. These are agencies where services to the public are being affected, including public housing, farmers, nutritional programs for children and the elderly, hospitals and health programs. End the shutdown. Reopen the government.
United States of America, everyone is loved.
interconnectedness of all our fights. Justice is not a concept we read about in a book. Justice is about the water we drink. Justice is about the air we breathe. Justice is about how easy it is to vote. Justice is about how much ladies get paid.
Been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash, and log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Way Out.
It is my hope that our coming together today will be one of healing. We are resilient. And we are beautiful.
Join me now for a quick trip around the globe as I introduce you to LGBT nominees for the 61st Grammy Awards.
Oh, listen to the music.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Lithuania's top court finds residence rights for queer foreign marrieds, the annual Women's March traverses intersectionalities, and rainbow artists seek Grammy glory. All that and more this week, now that you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Monique Lukens.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending January 19th, 2019. Lithuania's Constitutional Court has ruled that the Baltic nation must grant residence permits for the legally married foreign spouses of its gay and lesbian citizens. The nation's top court said that the routine denial of those permits was discriminatory and a violation of human dignity, even though Lithuania's constitution defines civil marriage as exclusively heterosexual. Vladimir Simonko of the Lithuanian Gay League called it a progressive ruling that sends an important message to our LGBT community and politicians. Not surprisingly, the Roman Catholic Church, the dominant faith of the country's 2.8 million people, condemned the decision. The Lithuanian Bishops Conference insisted in a statement that marriage, which is the foundation of the family, is contracted by the free will of a man and a woman. The authors of the Constitution, it argued, would have hardly agreed to what the Constitutional Court states in its ruling, which is that the constitutional concept of the family is gender neutral. The case centered on a gay man from Belarus who legally married a Lithuanian gay citizen in Denmark 3 years ago. National laws regulating the legal status of foreigners, the Constitutional Court decided, does not prohibit the issuance of a residence permit based on the civil marriage of a same-gender couple registered abroad.
But El Salvador's Constitutional Chamber of the Supreme Court of Justice has rebuffed a challenge to the Central American nation's family code that defines marriage as the legal union between a man and a woman. The lawsuit, filed by Rafael Alejandro Rodriguez Colocho, argued that denying the civil institution to same-gender couples violated their rights to freedom, equality, and legal security, and that specifically excluding them was an unconstitutional omission. But, reports ElSalvador.com, the High Court decision announced on January 17th said that the Constitution does not mandate lawmakers to regulate marriage between persons of the same sex. However, a January 2018 ruling by the Inter-American Court of Human Rights requires all countries in the region who have not already opened marriage to same-gender couples, and that's most of them, including El Salvador, to do so. And the country's constitutional chamber of the Supreme Court of Justice has other marriage equality cases in the pipeline, so the ruling in this particular case is not likely to be the last word on the issue there.
Meanwhile, Taiwan inaugurated a new premier this week following devastating election defeats for the incumbent. That happened on the same day that voters declared their preference for domestic partnerships for same-gender couples rather than opening civil marriage to them, as a May 2017 ruling by the island's constitutional court required within 2 years. LGBTQ activists are reportedly pressing new premier Su Sheng-Xiang to immediately introduce legislation to comply with that ruling. The High Court specified that marriage equality would automatically come into force if lawmakers take no action before May of this year.
The Russian LGBT network announced this week that at least 2 people have died and about 40 people have been detained in the latest roundup of gays and lesbians in the country's semi-autonomous Muslim-dominated region of Chechnya. A press release said that the 2 deaths occurred during torture and that it is impossible to name the precise number of victims. The purge, which began in 2017, revved up again last month, according to this week's Russian LGBT network press release describing the new wave of persecution. Local police make every effort to prevent the victims from leaving the region or seeking legal relief. A spokesman for Chechen strongman Ramzan Kadyrov told the Associated Press that reports of a crackdown on LGBTQ people are complete lies. Kadyrov, who claims that there are no gay people in Chechnya to persecute, has a cozy relationship with Russian President Vladimir Putin, who has insisted that his investigation of the matter has failed to reveal any evidence to support the charges.
Novaya Gazeta, one of Russia's few truly independent news sources, first reported the atrocities in April 2017, subsequently backed up by several other respected outlets. More than 100 gay and bisexual men were initially detained and tortured. As many as 26 died in custody, even before the crackdown expanded to include lesbians. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe issued a scathing report last month documenting extrajudicial killings and other human rights abuses against LGBTQ people in Chechnya. And that was before the latest wave of detentions began. Activists say the purge never stopped. It has just taken different forms. According to London's independent newspaper, the crackdown resumed in late December with the arrest of the administrator of a major online social network catering to gay men in the region. The Daily Beast reports that families in Chechnya are being ordered to kill their LGBTQ relatives, and that authorities are also demanding ransoms for the release of detained queer family members from those who can pay it.
An evangelical Christian group in the U.S. would probably feel right at home in Chechnya. The Liberty Council is lobbying members of Congress to remove specific protections for LGBTQ people in an anti-lynching bill. It may be surprising that the Justice for Victims of Lynching Act would be needed, but it's actually not a federal crime. And the Liberty Council's Matt Staver is telling any lawmaker who'll listen that protecting sexual and gender minorities from lynching will allow LGBTQ people to win more rights. The old saying is once that camel gets the nose in the tent, he argues, you can't stop it from coming the rest of the way in. The Southern Poverty Law Center has identified the Liberty Council as an anti-queer hate group. There have been several attempts over the years in the U.S. to pass a federal law against lynching, a practice that has particularly terrified African Americans since before the Civil War. Sadly, the mindset for such mob violence still exists today. The queer-inclusive bill passed unanimously in the Republican-controlled U.S. Senate in December. The newly sworn-in House of Representatives, with Democrats now in charge, is expected to pass it sometime soon.
New York legislators dealt a double blow to homophobia and transphobia this week. They passed a bill banning so-called conversion therapy for people under the age of 18, and another bill adding transgender people to the state's anti-discrimination and hate crime laws. In the past, each proposal had been approved by the Democratic-controlled State Assembly, but stalled in the Republican-controlled Senate. The November midterm elections gave Democrats control of both chambers, clearing the way for each of the bills to become law. Democratic Senator Brad Hoyleman sponsored both measures. He said that so-called conversion therapy is child abuse, plain and simple. New York becomes the 15th U.S. state to ban the practice. The Gender Expression Non-Discrimination Act, or GENDA, was first introduced 17 years ago, but if it passed in the New York State Assembly, the Senate killed it. The now approved GENDA outlaws bias based on gender identity or expression and adds protections for trans people to the Empire State's hate crimes law. Republican lawmakers in the U.S. Senate have opposed ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which would ban bias based on sexual orientation or gender identity and expression in federal law. New Democratic U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has already identified passage in her chamber as a top priority. But its fate in the Senate, as in the past, is, at best, uncertain.
And finally, pity poor put upon U.S. Vice President Mike Pence and his wife Karen, whom he calls Mother. She recently took a job teaching art at Emmanuel Christian School in Northern Virginia. It requires staff members and parents to sign a pledge that they don't participate in or condone homosexual or bisexual activities and refuses to enroll or would expel LGBTQ-identified students or the children of same-gender-headed or queer-supportive households. Karen Pence taught at the school during the 12 years that hubby Mike served in Congress. So Ma and Pa Pence just can't understand why people are making such a big fuss about the widely reported story now. The vice president told the Catholic network EWTN on January 16th that to see major news organizations attacking Christian education is deeply offensive to us. then they're certainly not going to like a donation to the school by the Trevor Project, which fights queer youth suicide. We previously told you about A Day in the Life of Marlon Bundo, a children's picture book offered by HBO's comedic news commentator John Oliver. It stars a gay rabbit couple as the heroes and a Pence-like stink bug as the villain, and parodies a book published by Karen Pence and daughter Charlotte about the family's pet rabbit of the same name. And outsold it, by the way, with all proceeds going to queer supportive charities. The Trevor Project announced that they've sent 100 copies of A Day in the Life of Marlon Bundo to the Emmanuel Christian School. The charity said that each book includes a note that encourages the school's leaders to accept LGBTQ young people.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending January 19, 2019. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at the ever-updating thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Anique Lukens.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
Make them laugh, make them laugh. Don't you know everyone wants to laugh?
I'm Kate Clinton, and while I can joke about the political state of our country, it's no laughing matter what Congress could do to our civil rights. An informed community is a strong community. That's why I'm inviting you to tune in to this station to hear This Way Out.
Timon lost all her fear. She knew Asaka was near.
Why don't you just meet me in the middle?
Don't ever let them steal your joy.
I am brave, I am bruised, I am who I'm meant to be. This is me.
Queers contend for Grammy Awards later in the program.
Never turning back. Never turning back.
Thousands filled the streets in cities across the United States and around the world for the annual Women's March on January 19th. This despite controversies regarding the leadership that threatened to dampen the event. It was the third such march during the presidency of Donald Trump. The first march was held the day after his inauguration in 2017. This Way Out's Lucia Chappell was at this year's Los Angeles march, where she says the queer presence was profound.
The Chorus of Los Angeles was performing on stage as I approached Los Angeles City Hall. Before long, I spotted a table flying the familiar blue banners emblazoned with the yellow equality symbol.
What's your name? My name is James Wen, and I serve on the Human Rights Campaign's Los Angeles Steering Committee. The Human Rights Campaign proudly supports Women's March Los Angeles. We're so proud that they are for intersectionality and for diversity.
There was no shortage of queer-related signs in the exuberant crowd.
What did your sign say?
Power Dykes Unite.
Why is it important for you to have that sign out here today?
I think visibility is really important, and community and togetherness is really important.
I'm an educator and an arts educator, and I think it's important to advocate for the next generation of feminists of all genders, and so that's why I'm out here today.
My sign says, matriarchy now, no woman free under patriarchy, know your privilege, and stop men.
How close do you think we are to overthrowing the patriarchy?
Closer than we've been in a very long time.
And why do you think so?
All these people around me right now and their signs and their spirits. I mean, we have to, or the environment's not going to last. This is our last chance for survival.
What did your sign say?
Gay witches unite. Trans inclusive feminists.
Why is it important for you to have that sign today?
Because trans women are at an intersection where they are probably the most marginalized group of people in the United States. unfortunately, they're not treated as human beings. And I don't think, as a community, as the LGBT community, we really need to make sure that we are helping lift them up and helping them get their rights and making sure that they're not being murdered. They are our sisters, and we need to protect them.
Do you think that that's being well represented here today in the Women's March?
I would like to believe so. I don't know if the Women's March is as diverse as I would like it to be. I do think that we can work towards that, and hopefully people get on board. Yeah.
The voice of the trans community was well represented by actress-activist Laverne Cox.
I am so honored to be here today to stand in solidarity with women of all kinds, all over the world, and with our allies and accomplices in the struggle. Our coming together today is a resistance. We come with demands for justice, for equity. We come today peaceably, but we also come to fight. And it is my hope that our coming together today will also be one of healing. We are resilient, and we are beautiful. And now I say we are beautiful because for many years, the shame of the traumas I experienced made me feel ugly, unworthy, and unlovable. 4 years ago, I started the hashtag #TransIsBeautiful to remind myself and other trans people that I am not beautiful despite my big hands, my big feet, my wide shoulders, my deep voice, and my height, all the things that make me noticeably trans. I'm beautiful because of those things, because trans is beautiful. And I'm not beautiful despite the sexual assaults I have survived, the beatings, the violence, the discrimination, the harassment. I am beautiful because I found a way to survive and acknowledge the truth of what has happened to me, but not be overly defined by those truths. To stand in these truths, these experiences, with love and forgiveness in my heart.
Reporting from Los Angeles for This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell.
Hi, I'm Lacey Dunaman.
And I'm Nova Gina.
And we are the Dreamtime Divas,
one of Australia's leading Aboriginal drag acts.
And you're listening to
This Way Out,
the weekly global community radio show produced by,
for and about the world's diverse sexual and gender variant minorities.
And those who love them.
The music world is gearing up for the Grammys, and on this edition of his This Way Out Music Focus, our Steve Sims has your queer scorecard all prepared.
Ooh, listen to the music all the time.
The Recording Academy's Grammy Awards represents the voices of performers, songwriters, producers, engineers, and it is the world's leading society of music professionals. Join me now for a quick trip around the globe as I introduce you to LGBT nominees for the 61st Grammy Awards.
Timon lost all her fear. She knew Asaka was near.
This is Alex Newell singing Mama Will Provide from the Grammy-nominated Best Musical Theater album Once on This Island. Alex, from Lynn, Massachusetts, is an actor and singer, best known for the role of transgender student Unique Adams on the Fox musical series Glee, and currently playing the role of Asaka in the Broadway revival of Once on This Island at the Circle in the Square Theater in New York.
Little girl, let me be your guy. Oh, a pretty singer like you.
Sh-sh-sh-sh-sh.
We'll need a sing or two.
Feeling nothing. I'm overwhelmed and insecure. Give me something.
This is the song In My Blood, written by American musician, singer-songwriter, and record producer Teddy Geiger. Teddy's In My Blood is nominated for Song of the Year. Originally signed to Columbia Records as an artist, Teddy now focuses on writing and production for other artists. In addition to Shawn Mendes, she has written songs for One Direction and James Blunt, and her song Stitches won the 2017 BMI Song of the Year Award.
It's like the walls are caving in. Sometimes I feel like giving up.
Right over there, sat on the stairs, stay or leave.
This is Grammy-nominated Song of the Year, The Middle. Sarah Ahrens, from Melbourne, Australia, is one of the co-writers of this number one top 40 song. Sarah also co-wrote Stay, another number one top 40 song. Stay in the Middle are both double platinum singles. This is Immaterial off of Grammy-nominated Best Dance Electronic Album, Oil of Every Pearl's Uninsides, from Scottish record producer, singer-songwriter Sophie. Known for her synthesized and hyperkinetic take on pop music, Sophie came to prominence with singles such as Bip from 2013 and 2014's Lemonade, which earned a nomination for Grammy Award for Best Dance Electronic Album. Sophie has worked closely with artists from the PC Music label and has produced for Madonna. Life. This is Waterfall, off of Michelle Endegeachello's album Ventriloquism, nominated for Best Urban Contemporary Album. Michelle is an American singer-songwriter, rapper, and bassist. Her music incorporates a wide variety of influences, including funk, soul, jazz, hip-hop, reggae, and rock. She's been nominated 10 times. She has been credited for helping to have sparked the neo-soul movement. This is Brandi Carlile, who this year is nominated for 7 Grammys, including Record of the Year and Song of the Year. Born in Ravensdale, Washington, she dropped out of high school to pursue a career in music, teaching herself piano and guitar. Her debut major label album, Brandi Carlile, was released to critical acclaim. Carlile garnered wider recognition with her 2007 single, The Story, from the album of the same name. The Story was awarded gold status in 2017. Her album, The Firewatcher's Daughter, earned her a Grammy nomination for Best Americana Album and peaked at number 9 on the Billboard 200.
Let them spin, let them scatter.
This is St. Vincent's Los Angeles, off of Mass Education, her album nominated for a Grammy for Best Alternative Music Album. St. Vincent is an American musician, singer, songwriter, and record producer. She studied at Berklee College of Music and began her career as a member of the Polyphonic Spree. She was also a member of Sufjan Stevens' touring band before forming her own band in 2006. Her work has received consistent praise for its distinct musical style, which blends soft rock, experimental rock, electropop, and jazz influences. She released a collaborative album with David Byrne in 2012 titled Love This Giant. She began playing her first real guitar at the age of 12 and worked some of her teenage years as a roadie for her aunt and uncle, the guitar-vocal jazz duo Tuck and Patty.
The stars, girls in cages, playing their guitars, but how can I leave? I just fall on the hood of my car.
I'm a bird gonna drown in my. I am brave, I am bruised, I am who I'm meant to be. This is me. Look out, 'cause here I come.
You're listening to This Is Me, nominated for a Grammy as Best Song Written for Visual Media. It's written by Pasek and Paul, an American songwriting duo and composing team for musical theater, films, and television. Their works include A Christmas Story, Dogfight, Edges, Dear Evan Hansen, and James and the Giant Peach. Their original songs have been featured on NBC's Smash and in the films La La Land, for which they won the Golden Globe and Academy Award for Best Original Song, and for the song City of Stars and The Greatest Showman. Their work on original musical Dear Evan Hansen has received widespread critical acclaim and earned them the Tony Award for Best Original Score.
Sit
This is the song Pink from Janelle Monáe, for which the video is nominated for a Grammy as Best Music Video. Janelle is an American singer, songwriter, actress, and producer. She dreamed of being a singer and performer from a very young age and has cited the fictional character of Dorothy Gale from The Wizard of Oz as a musical influence. Monáe's third studio album, Dirty Computer, was released on April 27, 2018. Pink, and you're blushing inside. This is the song Dancing Through the Wreckage from the album Served Like a Girl, for which Linda Perry is nominated for a Grammy for Producer of the Year Non-Classical. Served Like a Girl is music from and inspired by the documentary film. She's an American singer-songwriter, musician, and producer. She first became known as the lead singer and primary songwriter of Four Non-Blondes and has since founded two record labels and composed and produced hit songs for other artists such as Christina Aguilera, Gwen Stefani, and Pink. Perry has also contributed to albums by Adele, Alicia Keys, and Courtney Love, as well as signing and distributing James Blunt in the United States. She was inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame in 2015. Hallelujah, hallelujah. For This Way Out, I'm Steve Sims.
Cheer for your favorites when the Grammy Awards are handed out on February 10th. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Monique Lukens and Christopher Gall, produced with Brian DeShazer, Lucia Chappelle, and Steve Sims. Emma's Revolution performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks to Kicking Assets Funder of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, Paul Bannon, Christopher Matthews, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all of the listener donors who make this program possible. You can lend a hand by visiting thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WERU Bangor and Blue Hill Falls, Maine. Thanks again, friends. KKRP Collington, Oklahoma, 2ECR Eden, New South Wales, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Born on January 15, 1929 in Atlanta, assassinated on April 4, 1968 in Memphis, recruited in 1955 to serve as spokesman for the Montgomery bus boycott in Alabama. Elected president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in 1957, one of the driving forces behind the March on Washington in 1963, became in 1964, at the age of 35, the youngest person to win the Nobel Peace Prize, arrested 30 times for protesting racial segregation and injustice. So much else, so much more could be said about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the great civil rights leader and leading advocate of nonviolence, but we turn to what he said, to words he uttered in two locations, London in late 1964 and Hollywood 3 weeks before he was gunned down. We begin with portions of a talk he gave at a home in the Hollywood Hills in 1968. James Baldwin was there to introduce him. A number of other artists, writers, and performers were in attendance. Here is Dr. King speaking on March 16, 1968.
We have just heard from Marlon Brando that these are confusing times. And I don't think anyone would disagree with that. We are faced with a situation where we find restlessness among the poor and discontent among the affluent. And for some reason, it seems that this mammoth ship of state is not moving toward new and more secure shores, but toward old destructive rocks. It seems somehow that things are mixed up in our country. We have confused policies, confused priorities, and indeed confused purposes. I remember so well that President Johnson raised a question some weeks ago when he was giving his State of the Union address. He talked of all of the beautiful television sets that we have over the nation. In fact, he gave the number, about 70 or 80 million. He talked about the beautiful automobiles and the massive expressways that will hold our automobiles up and keep them flowing. He talked about the number of automobiles, new automobiles that come out every year. And he said after that, yet that is questioning in the land. That is a strange restlessness. And I guess he raised the question because he didn't quite know what was wrong. Well, there is something radically wrong. And I suspect it is that in all too many instances, we have allowed the means by which we live to outdistance the ends for which we live. We have maximized the minimum and minimized the maximum. And so we've ended up with guided missiles and misguided men. And I guess that's the basis of the questioning and the restlessness facing this generation. Our nation is in a mess. The world is in a mess. Now the question is, what do we do? And I must confess that I have no pretense to omniscience. I don't know everything, and the answers are hard to find today because of the great ambiguities of life and history. But we have to do something. Marlon Brando also mentioned the riot report, the Kerner report, that came out a few days ago. And it said some things to us that we cannot ignore. Some of us have been saying these things all along, but nobody paid much attention to them. Now, maybe after they have now been said by a presidential commission, and now that these things have the halo of respectability about them, maybe some people will listen. But in gloomy and realistic terms, that report pointed out that our nation is moving toward two societies, one white and one black, separate and unequal. And the fact is that with this kind of move taking place, hatreds are deeper, tensions are greater, misunderstanding will be wider. But the commission report didn't stop that. It brought out another thing that is often painful to hear. And yet it must be heard if the problems that we face in our nation are to be solved. And that is the fact that racism is still at the center of our nation. We must honestly face the fact that America is a racist society. And we must see racism for what it is. It is a myth of an inferior people. It is a tragic notion that one group has all of the worth and all of the knowledge, all of the significance, all of the purity. And another group has all of the inferiority, the worthlessness, and the impurity. And whenever racism is a basic philosophy, whether it is expressed overtly or whether it is subconsciously or latently held, It always brings into being an absolute disrespect for human personality. Now, the first thing that must be on the agenda of our nation is to get rid of racism in all of its dimensions. And it means that white America will have to do something positively, affirmatively, and meaningfully in order to bring all of God's children into the mainstream of the life of this nation. It cannot be done short of something massive. And it means that those who have not known the pathology of the ghetto will have to somehow take that empathetic journey and join hands with those who have been denied and who have been hurt and who have been exploited for so many years. Massive programs are needed. And that means billions of dollars. And the question is whether the affluent part of America is willing to make the sacrifice so that everybody will be able to live a creative life. I was saying earlier this afternoon to a group that sometimes the bootstrap philosophy can be exaggerated. Certainly, people should try desperately to lift themselves by their own bootstraps. But we must always understand that this cannot be an absolutistic philosophy. There's only so much that anybody can do. I was on a plane the other day, and a man started talking with me, and he said, the thing about your people is that they don't do anything for themselves. And he went on to say that all of the other ethnic groups have come to America, and they face problems just like your people, and yet they lifted themselves by their own bootstraps. And I looked at him and tried to talk with him in understanding terms. And I said, you know, it doesn't help the Negro for insensitive, unfeeling white people to say that other ethnic groups who have been in this country 100 or 150 years and who came voluntarily have gotten ahead of him, and he's been here almost 350 years, and he was brought here involuntarily in chains. And I went on to say to him that no other ethnic group has been a slave on American soil. And then I went on to bring out to him that the nation made the black man's color a stigma. And the fact is that when his color was made a stigma, that brought about a great sense of depression. There was no way to change it. And even linguistics and semantics conspired to make the Negro feel that he was nobody. If you open Roget's Thesaurus, you will find there some 120 synonyms for black. And virtually all of them represent something low, degrading, nasty, smut, dirty. You'll find about 130 synonyms for white. Almost everyone represents something high, pure, chaste, noble. And in a real sense, our children have so often been taught day in and day out 120 ways to feel that they are inferior, and whites have been taught 130 ways to feel that they are superior. And so white lie in our society is a little better than a black lie. If somebody goes wrong in the family, we don't call them a white sheep, we call them a black sheep. If we get mixed up in other ways with the law, we don't call it white male, we call it black male. We don't white ball people, we blackball them. Now, this sounds a bit humorous, but it is true, and one can see what happened after generations of oppression and denial, and a feeling that was developed because the color was made a stigma, that you are nobody. And so many Negro boys and girls grew up feeling this, that they didn't have any dignity and any worth. I went out a few months ago to a program where my son and daughter were appearing. They are attending an integrated school in Atlanta, and they were the first Negro kids to go to this particular school. And they had a program that night entitled Music That Made America Great. Both my son, my oldest son, my oldest daughter were in there. In the choir, and they were singing the music that made America great. And I listened to the music, and they had the music of various ethnic groups, beautiful music. And then I was waiting to hear some other music that I knew was great, the most original music on American soil, some of the most beautiful music that has ever come forth. Sometimes it emerges in sorrow songs, but it has some gentle sighings and glad thunders at times that can touch the soul, and it gave people hope. It lifted them. Great music. And I waited for it. And I never will forget that that concert came to an end, and there was not the singing of one Negro spiritual, or none of the music that has come into being out of the black people and out of the suffering and the agony of the black people of this country. Instead of that, the program ended with the singing of Dixie. And I looked at my son and my daughter having to end the program singing Dixie, the music that made America great. And I sat there and all but wept within. And I said to myself, how can they ever feel that they are somebody if they feel that they have no heritage, if they feel that they've done nothing or given nothing to the life of the world and to history? And how can these white students ever get rid of their prejudices and their feelings of inferiority or superiority until they know these things? And somehow we will never have an integrated society until we see these things. Until we come to see that integration is not a problem, but an opportunity to participate in the beauty of diversity. And these things don't always get across. I was trying in my little way to get this over to that man who didn't understand this. And I had to finally tell him another thing that is often overlooked. I had to say to him that nobody, no group has totally lifted itself by its own bootstraps. I reminded him of the fact that in 1863 a document was signed by Abraham Lincoln, which was to free the Negro from the bondage of physical slavery, but it didn't give him any land to make that freedom meaningful. You know, it was something like keeping a man in prison for many, many years and suddenly discovering that he is not guilty of the crime for which he was convicted, and then just going up to him saying, now you are free. But you don't give him any bus fare to get to town. You don't give him any money to get any clothes to put on his back, nothing to get on his feet in life again. Every code of jurisprudence would rise up against this. But yet this is exactly what America did to the black man. It simply said, you are free. And by the thousands and millions, 4 million to be exact, they stood there penniless, illiterate, not knowing where to go and what to do. And the irony of it all is that at that same time, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did it give the land, it built land-grant colleges to teach them how to farm. It provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. It provided later on low interest rates so that they could mechanize their farms. And today, millions of these people, or thousands of them at least, are being paid millions of dollars a year in federal subsidies not to farm. Senator Eastland, whom you may know, gets about $125,000 a year not to farm on various sections of his plantation in Mississippi. And yet these are the very people who tell the black people of America that they must lift themselves by their own bootstraps.
That's Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speaking on March 16th, 1968 at a house in the Hollywood Hills. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Today, we're presenting portions of two talks given by Dr. King. Let's return to more of Dr. King's remarks, given less than 3 weeks before he was assassinated in Memphis.
The problem can only be solved when there is a kind of coalition of conscience. Now, I'm not sure if we have that many consciences left. Too many have gone to sleep. But there are some left. And we've got to be that something that Arnold Toynbee, the historian, refers to as a creative minority, ready to do battle for the sacred, vital, valid issues of life, ready to do battle for the principles of justice and goodwill and peace and brotherhood. There are a lot of poor people in our nation. We've seen them in various ways, but so often we don't allow ourselves to see them. And therefore they become invisible. The invisible poor. I would not fool you when I say that I've been in the Delta of Mississippi, and I've been in the little shacks of people who earn less than $400 a year. I wouldn't be fooling you if I told you that I've been through the slums of Chicago. I lived in one. I've been through the slums of Cleveland. I lived there for about 6 months last year. And I would not be telling you an untruth. And I say to you that I've seen young Negro men and women not earning enough money, and their parents not earning enough money, to begin to function in the mainstream of life. I've seen the lead poisoning in their houses. I've seen the rats and I've seen the roaches. I've seen them. Because they didn't get much sleep that night. They had to stay awake to keep the rats away from their children. I've seen these things with my own eyes. And sometimes out of despair, out of agony, and out of the ache and anguish of their daily lives, they try to forget it all and they try to escape. Sometimes they turn out of humiliation to dope addiction, alcoholism, not wanting to face it. Sometimes a father will end up leaving his family because the welfare law says that a family can't get welfare if there's an able-bodied man in the house. And here he is unemployed, not able to get a job, but he's in the house. And so for humanitarian reasons, he ends up deserting the family so that the children can get something to eat. I've seen these things happen. Now the job facing the nation today is to get rid of poverty. We are the richest nation in the history of the world. Our national gross product this year is about $800 billion. That is what it is, the richest nation in the history of the world. It wouldn't take much to do what I'm talking about. It wouldn't take a great percentage of that national gross product to do what I'm talking about. If the haves are willing to somehow join hands with the have-nots and armed with compassionate traveler's checks, journey into that other country of their brother's hurt and denial and neglect, it wouldn't take that much. We've done it before. We talk in Congress about rewarding the rioters. And I've heard congressmen standing up saying they aren't going to reward the rioters. And I think of the fact that we developed a Marshall Plan after Hitler had destroyed a great deal of Europe. We built it back up. We built a great deal of Germany back up. And nobody said you are rewarding the Nazis. And that is something shameful about a nation with people who have lived in it all of these years, because in anger, in moments of understandable bitterness, they exploded into violence, and the only response is to call for a day of prayer and the appointment of a commission, and then the president won't even say a kind word about his own commission's report. It is time now for something positive to take place. And this is why we're going to have a campaign in Washington. This is why we're going with poor people. I don't know what we'll be able to do in Washington. Frankly, I know we've got to do something. I know we've got to take the inchoate rage of the ghetto and transform it into a constructive and creative force. It is not enough for an oppressed people to be angry, because anger is not a program. It is necessary to unite and organize so that that anger can be transformed into a creative and constructive force. And this is what we are trying to do in our Poor People's Campaign in Washington, taking the power of direct action, keeping this issue before the attention of the nation, developing a movement that is dramatic and attention-getting, so that for at least 60 days, nobody in this country can overlook the fact that there are poor people around. And we solicit your support as we go to Washington, not to beg, but to demand jobs or income now. Now, there's one other thing. One other thing that I'd like to say, and that is, we can't have a campaign like this in Washington without recognizing the fact that as long as a war in Vietnam is taking place, we cannot seriously address ourselves to the great problems, the blight, the despair, the slum conditions of our cities. And that this is why I have been determined to keep these two issues together. There comes a time when silence is betrayal. And I had watched that war in Vietnam, and I came to see that I could no longer be silent about it. Our nation is committing a grave crime, and I'm convinced if we, the people of goodwill, don't unite and keep the pressure on and demand an end to that war in Vietnam, that the curtain of doom may well come down on American civilization. The soul of our nation is being lost. Our image is terribly scarred. We are morally and politically isolated all over the world. There isn't a single ally, former ally in terms of a major nation in the world that would dare send a troop to Vietnam. Not only are we morally and politically isolated in the world, we are playing havoc with our domestic destinies. Not only that, we are saying to the world that we are a terribly arrogant nation. Senator Fulbright calls it the arrogance of power. And we are arrogant in feeling that we have everything to teach every other nation and nothing to learn about them and learn from them. We are arrogant in feeling that we are fighting for the rights, in quotes, of another people, and we won't put our own house in order. We are arrogant in sending young black men and white men to fight in brutal solidarity on the battlefields of Vietnam. And yet when they come back home, it is doubtful that they'll be able to live together on the same block. These are the facts of life. But not only that, the longer we stay in the war in Vietnam, the closer and closer we push the whole human race to destruction. So we must oppose this war. We must oppose it because it's evil, it's unjust, it's inhuman, and because it can destroy everybody. There are those who say to me, you should stick to civil rights and don't mix these issues. And I always have to say that it would be rather absurd for me to be working for integrated housing and integrated schools and not be concerned about the survival of a world in which to integrate. And I think we've got to see that the question now is the survival of mankind. John Fitzgerald Kennedy said on one occasion, mankind must put an end to war. A war will put an end to mankind. This is where we are today. And so let us continue to stand up for peace, and let us continue to stand up for freedom and justice. Let me say in conclusion that even though our struggle is much more difficult now, and it's more difficult because it's going to cost something. It's going to cost billions of dollars. As I said earlier today, it's easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to eradicate slums. It's easier to guarantee the right to vote than it is to guarantee a guaranteed annual income or to create jobs. And so things are more difficult now. And I must honestly confess that I go through those moments of disappointment when I have to recognize the fact that there aren't enough white persons in our country who are willing to cherish democratic principles over privilege. But I'm grateful to God that some are left. And I say to you that our goal is freedom. I believe we're going to get there, however difficult it is. And I believe we're going to get there because however much she strays away from it, the goal of America is freedom. And our destiny is tied up with the destiny of America. Abused and scorned though we may be as a people, our destinies are tied together. Before the Pilgrim Fathers landed at Plymouth, we were here. Before Jefferson etched across the pages of history the majestic words of the Declaration of Independence, we were here. Before the beautiful words of the Star-Spangled Banner were written, we were here. And for more than two centuries, our forebears labored here without wages. They made cotton king. They built the homes of their masters in the midst of the most humiliating and exploitative conditions, and yet out of a bottomless vitality, they continue to grow and develop. And if the inexpressible cruelties of slavery couldn't stop us, the opposition that we now face, including the so-called white backlash, will surely fail. We're going to win our freedom.
The voice, the unmistakable voice of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He gave that talk in Hollywood on March 16, 1968. You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. And the rest of the hour we devote to a speech delivered by Dr. King in London. The date was December 7, 1964, just one day before he left for Oslo, Norway, to accept the Nobel Peace Prize. Here is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speaking at the City Temple Hall in London.
We must think of the fact that there is nothing more dangerous than to build a society with a segment in that society which feels that it has no stake in the society. There's nothing more dangerous than to build a society with a number of people who see life as little more than a long and desolate corridor with no exit sign. They end up with despair because they have no jobs, because they can't educate their children, because they can't live in a nice home, because they can't have adequate health facilities. We always hear of the various reasons why and the various myths concerning integration and why integration shouldn't come into being. Those people who argue against integration at this point often say, if you integrate the public schools, for instance, you will pull the white race back a generation. And they like to talk about the cultural lag in the Negro community. And then they go on to say, the Negro is a criminal and he has the highest crime rate in any city that you can find in the United States. And the arguments go on ad infinitum why integration shouldn't come into being. But I think there's an answer to that. And that is that if there is cultural lag in the Negro community, and there certainly is, this lag is there because of segregation and discrimination. It's there because of long years of slavery and segregation. Criminal responses are not racial, but environmental. Poverty, economic deprivation, social isolation, and all of these things breed crime, whatever the racial group may be. And it is a torturous logic to use the tragic results of racial segregation as an argument for the continuation of it. And so it is necessary to see this and to go all out to make economic justice a reality all over our nation. I mentioned that racial segregation is about dead in the United States, but it's still with us. We are about past the day of legal segregation. We have about ended de jure segregation, where the laws of the nation or of a particular state can uphold it because of the Civil Rights Bill and the Supreme Court's decision and other things. We have passed a day when the Negro can't eat at a lunch counter, with the exception of a few isolated situations, or where the Negro can't check in a motel or a hotel. We are fastly passing that day. But that is another form of segregation coming up. It is coming up through housing discrimination, joblessness, and the de facto segregation in the public schools. And so the ghettoized conditions that exist make for many problems, and it makes for a hardcore de facto segregation that we must grapple with on a day-to-day basis. Now, as you know, we have been engaged in the United States in a massive struggle to make desegregation and finally integration a reality. And in that struggle, there has been an undergirding philosophy, the philosophy of nonviolence, the philosophy and method of nonviolent resistance. And I'd like to say just a few words about the method or the philosophy that has undergirded our struggle. And first, I want to say that I'm still convinced that nonviolence is the most potent weapon available to oppressed people in their struggle for freedom and justice. It has a way of disarming the opponent, exposing his moral defenses. It weakens his morale, and at the same time, it works on his conscience, and he just doesn't know how to handle it. If he doesn't beat you, wonderful. If he beats you, you develop the quiet courage of accepting blows without retaliating. If he doesn't put you in jail, wonderful. Nobody with any sense loves to go to jail. But if he puts you in jail, you go in that jail and transform it from a dungeon of shame to a haven of freedom and human dignity. Even if he tries to kill you, you develop the inner conviction that there are some things so dear, some things so precious, some things so eternally true, that they are worth dying for. And if a man has not discovered something that he will die for, he isn't fit to live. And this is what the nonviolent discipline says. And then the other thing about it is that it gives the individual a way of struggling to secure moral ends through moral means. One of the great debates of history has been over the whole question of ends and means. And all the way back from the days of Plato's dialogues, coming on up through Machiavelli and others, there have been those individuals who argued that the end justifies the means. But in a real sense, a nonviolent philosophy comes along and says that the end is pre-existent in the means. The means represent the ideal in the making and the end in process. And so that in the long run of history, immoral means cannot bring about moral ends. Somehow man must come to the point that he sees the necessity of having ends and means cohering, so to speak. And this is one of the things that is basic in the nonviolent philosophy at its best. It gives one a way and a method of struggle which says that you can seek to secure moral ends through moral means. It also says that it is possible to struggle against an evil, unjust system with all your might and with all your heart, and even hate that unjust system, but yet you maintain an attitude of active goodwill and understanding and even love for the perpetrators of that evil system. Now, this is the most misunderstood aspect of nonviolence. And this is where those who don't want to follow the nonviolent method say a lot of bad things to those of us who talk about love. But I still go on and believe in it, because I am still convinced that it is love that makes the world go round. And somehow this kind of love can be a powerful force for social change. Now, I'm not talking about a weak love. I'm not talking about emotional bosh here. I'm not talking about some sentimental quality. I'm not talking about an affectionate response. It would be nonsense to urge oppressed people to love their violent oppressors in an affectionate sense, and I have never advised that. When Jesus said, love your enemies, I'm happy he didn't say like your enemies. It's pretty difficult to like some people. But love is greater than like. Love is understanding, creative, redemptive goodwill for all men. Theologians talk about this kind of love with the Greek word agape, which is a sort of overflowing love that seeks nothing in return. And when one develops this, you rise to the position of being able to love the person who does the evil deed while hating the deed that the person does. And I believe that this can be done. Psychiatrists are telling us now that hatred is a dangerous force, not merely for the hated, but also the hater. Many of the strange things that happen in the subconscious, many of the inner conflicts are rooted in hate. And so they are saying love or perish. This is why Eric Fromm can write a book entitled The Art of Loving, arguing that love is the supreme unifying force of life. And so it is wonderful to have a method of struggle where it is possible to stand up against segregation, to stand up against colonialism with all of your might, and yet not hate the perpetrators of these unjust systems. And I believe firmly that it is through this kind of powerful, nonviolent
action, this kind of love that organizes itself into mass action, that we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation and the world into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. Certainly, this is the great challenge facing us. I understand there are here tonight our South Africans, some of whom have been involved in the long struggle for freedom there, and our struggle for freedom and justice in the United States, which has also been so long and difficult. We feel a powerful sense of identification with those in the far more deadly struggle for freedom in South Africa. We know how Africans there and their friends of other races strove for half a century to win their freedom by nonviolent methods. We have honored Chief Luthuli for his leadership, and we know how this nonviolence was only met by increasing violence from the state, increasing repression, culminating in the shootings at Sharpeville and all that has happened since. Clearly, there's much in Mississippi and Alabama to remind the South Africans of their own country. Yet even in Mississippi, we can organize to register Negro voters. We can speak to the press. We can, in short, organize the people in nonviolent action. But in South Africa, even the mildest form of nonviolent resistance meets with years of imprisonment. And leaders over many years have been restricted and silenced and imprisoned. We can understand how, in that situation, people felt so desperate that they turned to other methods such as sabotage. Today, great leaders like Nelson Mandela and Robert Sobukwe are among the many hundreds wasting away in Robben Island prison against a massive, armed, and ruthless state, which uses torture and sadistic forms of interrogation to crush human beings, even driving some to suicide. The militant opposition inside South Africa seems for the moment to be silenced. The mass of the people seems to be contained, seems for the moment unable to break from the oppression. I emphasize the word "this seems" because we can imagine what emotions and plans must be seething below the calm surface of that prosperous police state. We know what emotions are seething in the rest of Africa, and indeed all over the world. The dangers of a race war, these dangers we have had repeated in profound warning. It is in this situation, with the great mass of South Africans denied their humanity, their dignity, and denied opportunity, denied all human rights, it is in this situation, with many of the bravest and best South Africans serving long years of prison, in prison, with some already executed, in this situation, we in America and Britain have a unique responsibility. For it is we, through our investments, through our government's failure to act decisively, who are guilty of bolstering up the South African tyranny. Our responsibility presents us with a unique opportunity. We can join in the one form of nonviolent action that could bring freedom and justice to South Africa, the action which African leaders have appealed for in a massive movement for economic sanctions. In a world living under the appalling shadow of nuclear weapons, do we not recognize the need to perfect the use of economic pressures? Why is trade regarded by all nations and all ideologies as sacred? Why does our government and your government in Britain refuse to intervene effectively now, as if only when there is a bloodbath in South Africa or the Korea or the Vietnam will they recognize a crisis? And may I say to you that the problem of racial injustice is not limited to any one nation. We know now that this is a problem spreading all over the globe. And right here in London and right here in England, you know so well that thousands and thousands of colored people are migrating here from many, many lands, from the West Indies, from Pakistan, from India, from Africa. And they have the just right to come to this great land. And they have the just right to expect justice and democracy in this land. And England must be eternally vigilant. For if not, the same kind of ghettos will develop that we have in the Harlems of the United States. The same problems of injustice, the same problems of inequality in jobs will develop. And so I say to you that the challenge before every citizen of goodwill of this nation is to go all out to make democracy a reality for everybody, so that everybody in this land will be able to live together, and that all men will be able to live together as brothers. You know, there are certain words in every academic discipline that soon become stereotypes and cliches. Every academic discipline has its technical vocabulary. Modern psychology has a word that is probably used more than any other word in modern psychology. It is the word maladjusted. You've heard that word. This is the ringing cry of modern child psychology. And certainly we all want to live well-adjusted lives in order to avoid neurotic and schizophrenic personalities. But I must say to you this evening, my friends, as I come to a close, that there are some things in my own nation, and there are some things in the world which I'm proud to be maladjusted, to which I call upon all men of goodwill to be maladjusted until the good society is realized. I must honestly say to you that I never intend to become adjusted to segregation, discrimination, colonialism, and these particular forces. I must honestly say to you that I never intend to adjust myself to religious bigotry. I must honestly say to you that I never intend to adjust myself to economic conditions that will take necessities from the many to give luxuries to the few. I must say to you tonight that I never intend to become adjusted to the madness of militarism and the self-defeating effects of physical violence. But in a day when Sputniks and explorers are dashing throughout a space, and guided ballistic missiles are carving highways of death through the stratosphere, no nation can win a war. It is no longer the choice between violence and nonviolence. It is either nonviolence or non-existence. The alternative to disarmament, the alternative to a greater suspension of nuclear tests, the alternative to strengthening the United Nations and thereby disarming the whole world may well be a civilization plunged into the abyss of annihilation. And I assure you that I will never adjust to the madness of militarism. You see, it may well be that our whole world is in need at this time for a new organization, the International Association for the Advancement of Creative Maladjustment.
You've been listening to portions of a public lecture given by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in London. Dr. King had been invited by the group Christian Action London to give the talk delivered at the City Temple Hall on December 7th, 1964. Audio of both talks you heard today, talks that were edited by yours truly, were provided by the Pacifica Radio Archives. And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.